hole there.
Lost a tooth?
Ah, yeah. It was laying in the crotch of my pants when I woke up. Fell out when I was sleeping, I guess. But I ain't hardly ever had any trouble with my teeth, at least not since that one wisdom tooth got impacted and damn near killed me. By then, it coming on dark.
Dark?
I know how it sounds, don't you worry, Del said crossly, but it was the crossness of someone who was deeply ashamed. I just slept all the afternoon away, and when I got up, Ev...
His eyes rolled up to meet Ev's for one miserable second and then shifted away, as if he could not bear to look his old friend in the eye for longer than that one second.
It was like something stole my brains.
The tooth fairy, mayhap.
Del laughed, but there hadn't been much humor in the sound.
I wandered around for a while, thinking I was following the pole star, and when I still hadn't come out on the hammer-cut road by 9 o'clock or so, I kind of rubbed my eyes and saw it wasn't Polaris at all, but one of the planets, Mars or Saturn, I guess. I laid down to sleep, and until I came out along Preston Stream a week later, I don't remember nothing but little bits and pieces.
Well, Ev halted.
It sounded entirely unlike Del, whose head was as level as a carpenter's plane.
Well, was you panicked, Del?
Del's eyes rolled up to meet Ev's, and they were still ashamed, but there was also a leaven of real humor in them now.
A man can't stay in a panic for a whole week, I don't believe, he said dryly. It's awful tiring.
So you just...
I just... Del agreed.
But just what? I don't know.
I know that when I woke up from that nap, my feet and my ass was both asleep and all numb, and I know that in one of those dreams it seemed like I heard something humming, the way you can hear power lines hum on a still day, you know, and that's all. I forgot all my woodcraft and wandered around the woods like somebody who'd never even seen the woods before. When I hit Preston Stream, I knew enough to follow it out, and I woke up in here. And I guess I'm a laughingstock in town, but I'm grateful to be alive. It's God's mercy that I am.
You ain't a laughingstock, Del, Ev said, and of course that was a lie, because that was exactly what Del was.
He worked at overcoming it for nearly 5 years, and when he saw for sure that the barbershop wits were never going to let him live it down, he moved up to East Eddington and opened a combination garage and small engine repair shop. Ev still got up to see him once in a while, but Del didn't come down to Haven much anymore. Ev guessed he knew why.
10.
Sitting in his rented room, Ev closed the compass up as tight as it would go and drew the tiniest circle yet, the smallest the compass would make. There was only one house inside this marble-sized circle, and he thought, that house is the closest one there is to the center of Haven. Funny I never thought about it before. It was the old Garrick place, sitting there on Derry Road with Big Engine Woods widening out behind it. Should have drawn this last circle in red, if no other. Frank's niece Bobby Anderson lived on the Garrick place now. Not that she farmed, of course. She wrote books. Ev hadn't passed many words with Bobby, but she had a good reputation in town. She paid her bills on time, folks said, and didn't gossip. Also, she wrote good old Western stories that you could really sink your teeth into, not all full of make-believe monsters and a bunch of dirty words, like the ones that fella who lived up in Bangor wrote. Goddamn good Westerns, people said. Especially for a girl. People in Haven felt good about Bobby Anderson. But, of course, she'd just been in town for 13 years, and people would have to wait and see. Garrick, most agreed, had been as crazy as a shithouse rat. He always brought in a good garden, but that didn't change his mental state. He was always trying to tell someone about his dreams. They were usually about the second coming. After a while it got so that even Arlene Cullum, who sold Amway with the zeal of a Christian martyr, would make herself scarce when she saw Frank Garrick's truck plastered with bumper stickers which said things like, "If the rapture's today, somebody grab my steering wheel," driving down the village's main street. In the late 60s, the old man had gotten a bee in his bonnet about flying saucers. Something about Elijah seeing a wheel within a wheel and being taken up to heaven by angels driving chariots of fire powered by electromagnetism. He had been crazy, and he had died of a heart attack in 1975. But before he died, Ev thought with rising coldness, he lost all his teeth. I noticed it, and I remember Justin Hurd just down the road commenting on it, and now Justin's the closest, except for Bobby herself, that is. And Justin also wasn't what you'd call a model of sanity and reason. A few times I saw him before I left, he even reminded me of old Frank. It was odd, he thought at first, that he had never put together the run of peculiar things that had happened within those two inner circles before, that no one had. Further reflection made him decide it really wasn't so strange after all. A life, particularly a long one, was composed of millions of events. They made a crowded tapestry with many patterns woven into it. Such a pattern as this, the deaths, the murders, the lost hunters, crazy Frank Garrick, maybe even that queer fire at the Polsons, only showed up if you were looking for it. Once seen, you wondered how you could have missed it. But if you weren't. And now a new thought dawned. Bobby Anderson was perhaps not all right. He remembered that since the beginning of July, perhaps even before, there had been sounds of heavy machinery coming from Big Engine Woods. Ev had heard the sounds and dismissed them. Maine was heavily forested, and the sounds were all too familiar. New England paper doing a spot of logging on its land, most likely. Except now that he thought about it, now that he had seen the pattern, Ev realized that the sounds weren't deep enough in the woods to be on NEP's land. Those sounds were coming from the Garrick place. And he also realized that the earlier sounds, the cycling, waspy whine of a chainsaw, the crackle-crunch of falling trees, the coughing roar of a gas-powered chipper, had given way to sounds he didn't associate with woods work at all. The later sounds had been, what, earth-moving machinery, perhaps. Once you saw the pattern, things fell into place like the last dozen pieces going effortlessly into a big jigsaw puzzle. Ev sat looking down at the map and the circles. A numbing horror seemed to be filling his veins, freezing him from the inside out. Once you saw the pattern, you couldn't help seeing it. Ev slammed the atlas shut and went to bed. 11. Where he was unable to sleep. What are they doing down there tonight? Building things? Making people disappear? What? Every time he drifted near sleep, an image came. Everyone in Haven Village standing in Main Street with drugged, dreamy expressions on their faces, all of them looking southwest, toward those sounds, like Muslims facing Mecca to pray. Heavy machinery. Earth-moving machinery. As the pieces went into the puzzle, you began to see what it was, even if there was no picture on the box to help you. Lying in his narrow bed not far from where Hilly lay in his coma, Ev Hillman thought he saw the picture pretty well. Not all of it, mind you, but a lot. He saw it and knew perfectly well no one would believe him. Not without proof. And he dared not go back, dared not put himself in their reach. They would not let him go a second time. Something. Something out in Big Engine Woods. Something in the ground. Something on the land Frank Garrick had willed to his niece, who wrote those Western books. Something that knocked compasses and human minds galley west if you got too close. For all Ev knew, there might be such strange deposits all over the earth. If it did nothing else, it might explain why people in some places seemed so goddamn pissed off all the time. Something bad. Haunted. Maybe even accursed. Ev stirred restlessly, rolled over, looked at the ceiling. Something had been in the earth. Bobby Anderson had found it, and she was digging it up, her and that fella who was staying out at the farm with her. That fella's name was... Ev groped, but couldn't come up with it. He remembered the way Beach Jernigan's mouth had thinned when the subject of Bobby's friend came up one day in the Haven lunch. The regulars on coffee break had just observed the man coming out of the market with a bag of groceries. He had a place over in Troy, Beach said, a shacky little place with a wood stove and plastic over the windows. Someone said he'd heard the fellow was educated. Beach said an education never kept anyone from being no account. No one in the lunch had argued the point, Ev remembered. Nancy Voss had been equally disapproving. She said Bobby's friend had shot his wife, but had been let off because he was a college professor. If you got a sheepskin written in Latin words in this country, you can get away with anything, she had said. They had watched the fellow get into Bobby's truck and drive back toward the old Garrick place. I heard he done majored in drinkin', old Dave Rutledge said from the end stool that was his special place. Everyone goes out there says he's most all as drunk as a coon on stump liquor. There had been a burst of mean, gossipy country laughter at that. They hadn't liked Bobby's friend. None had. Why? Because he had shot his wife? Because he drank? Because he was living with a woman he wasn't married to? Ev knew better. There had been men in the lunch that day who had not just beaten their wives, but beaten them into entirely new shapes. Out here it was part of the code. You were obligated to put one upside the old woman's head if she got smat. Out here were men who lived on beer from 11 in the morning until 6 at night, and cheap green front whiskey from 6 to midnight, and would drink old woodsman's fly dope strained through a snot rag if they couldn't afford whiskey. Men who had the sex lives of rabbits jumping from hole to hole. And what had his name been? Ev drifted toward sleep. Saw them standing on the sidewalks, on the lawn of the public library, over by the little park, staring dreamily toward those sounds. Snapped awake again. What did you find out, Ruth? Why did they murder you? He tossed onto his left side. David's alive. But to bring him back, I have to start in Haven. He tossed onto his right side. They'll kill me if I go back. There was once a time when I was almost as well liked there as Ruth herself. At least I always liked to think so. Now they hate me. I saw it in their eyes the night they started looking for David. I took Hilly out because he was sick and needed the doctor, yes. But it was damn good to have a reason to go. Maybe they only let me go because David distracted them. Maybe they just wanted to be rid of me. Either way, I was lucky to get out. I'd never get out again. So how can I go back? I can't. Ev tossed and turned, caught on the horns of two imperatives. He would have to go back to Haven if he wanted to rescue David before David died. But if he went back to Haven, he would be killed and buried quickly in someone's back field. Sometime shortly before midnight, he fell into a troubled doze, which quickly deepened into the dreamless sleep of utter exhaustion. 12. He slept later than he had in years, awakening on Tuesday at 10:15. He felt refreshed and whole for the first time in a long while. The sleep had done him a power of good, too. During it, he had thought of how he could maybe get back into Haven and out again. Maybe. For David's sake, and Hilly's. That was the risk he would take. He thought he could get in and out of Haven on the day of Ruth McCausland's funeral. 13. Butch Monster Dugan was the biggest man Ev had ever seen. Ev believed that Justin Hurd's father Henry might have been within a shout. Henry had stood 6'6", weighed 380 pounds, and had shoulders so broad he had to go through most doors sideways. But Ev thought this fellow was a tad bigger. 20 or 30 pounds lighter, maybe, but that was all. When Ev shook his hand, he saw that word on him had been getting around. It was in Dugan's face. "Sit down, Mr. Hillman," Dugan said, and seated himself in a swivel chair that looked as if it might have been rammed out of a huge oak. "What can I do for you?" "He expects me to start raving," Ev thought calmly, "just the way we always expected Frank Garrick to start when he caught up to one of us on the street. And I guess I ain't going to disappoint him. But if you step careful, Ev, you may still get your way.
You know now where you want to go, anyway. Well, maybe you could do something at that, Ev said. At least he hadn't been drinking. Trying to talk to that reporter after those beers had been a bad mistake. Paper says you'll be going to Ruth McCausland's funeral tomorrow.
Dugan nodded. I'm going. Ruth was a personal friend.
And there are others from Derry Barracks that'll be going. Paper said her husband was a trooper, and she was in the line of police work herself. Oh, being a town constable's no great shakes, I know, but you get what I mean. There will be others, won't there?
Dugan was frowning now, and he had a lot of face to frown with. Mr. Hillman, if you have a point to make, I'm not getting it. And I'm a busy man this morning, in case you didn't know it, his face added. I've got two cops missing. It's starting to look more and more like they ran into some guys jacking deer, and the jackers panicked and shot them. I'm on the hot seat on that one. And on top of it all, my old friend Ruth McCausland has died, and I don't have either the time or the patience for bullshit.
I know you're not, but you will. Did she have other friends who will be going?
Yes, half a dozen or more. I'm going by myself, starting a little early so I can talk to some people about a related case. Ev nodded.
I know about the related case, he said, and I guess you know about me.
Or think you do.
Mr. Hillman, I have talked foolishly and to the wrong people and at the wrong times, Ev said in that same calm voice. Under other circumstances, I would have known better, but I've been upset. One of my grandsons is missing. The other is in a sort of coma.
Yes, I know.
I've been so confused, I haven't really known if I was coming or going. So I blabbed to some of the nurses, and then I went up to Bangor and talked to a reporter. Bright. I kind of got the idea you'd heard most of the things I had to say to him.
I understand you believe there was some sort of conspiracy in the matter of David Brown's disappearance.
Ev had to struggle to keep from laughing.
The word was both bizarre and apt. He never would have thought of it himself. Oh, there was a conspiracy going on, all right. One hell of a conspiracy.
Yes, sir. I believe there was a conspiracy, and I think you've got three cases that are a lot more related than you understand. The disappearance of my grandson, the disappearance of those two troopers, and the death of Ruth McCausland, my friend as well as yours.
Dugan looked a bit startled, and for the first time that dismissive look went out of his eyes. For the first time Ev felt that Dugan was really seeing him. Everett Hillman, instead of just some crazy old rip who had blown in to fart away part of his morning.
"Perhaps you'd better give me the gist of what you believe," Dugan said, and took out a pad of paper. "No, you could just put that pad away."
Dugan looked at him silently for a moment. He didn't put the pad away, but he put down the pencil.
"Bright thought I was crazy, and I didn't tell him half of what I thought," Ev said. "So I ain't going to tell you any. But here's the thing. I think David's still alive. I don't think he's in Haven anymore, but I think if I went back there, I might be able to get an idea on where he is. Now, I have reasons, pretty good ones, I think, to believe that I'm not wanted in Haven. I have reasons to think that if I went back there under most circumstances, I'd most likely disappear like David Brown. Or have an accident, like Ruth."
Butch Dugan's face changed.
"I think," he said, "I got to ask you to explain that, Mr. Hillman." "I ain't going to. I can't. I know what I know, and believe what I believe, but I ain't got a speck of proof. I know how crazy I must sound, but if you look into my face, you'll know one thing at least. I believe what I'm saying."
Dugan sighed. "Mr. Hillman, if you were in this business, you'd know how sincere most liars look." Ev started to say something, and Dugan shook his head.
"Forget that, cheap shot. I've only had about 6 hours sleep since Sunday night. I'm getting too old for these marathons. Fact is, I do believe you're sincere. But you're only making ominous sounds, talking around the edges of things. Sometimes people do that when they're scared, but Mostly they do it when edges are all they have. Either way, I haven't got time to woo you. I answered your questions. Maybe you'd better state your business.
Glad to. I came here for two reasons, Trooper Dugan. First one was to make sure there was going to be a lot of cops in Haven tomorrow. Things are less likely to happen when there are a lot of cops around, don't you agree?
Dugan said nothing, only looked at Ev expressionlessly.
Second was to tell you I'll be in Haven tomorrow, too. I won't be at Ruth's funeral, though. I'm going to have a Very pistol with me, and if, during that funeral, you or any of your men should see a big old star shell go off in the sky, you'll know I have run afoul of some of that craziness no one will believe. Do you follow me?
You said going back to Haven might be, unhealthy for you. Dugan's face was still blank, but that didn't matter. Ev knew he had gone back to his original idea. Ev was crazy, after all.
"Under most circumstances," I said. "Under these circumstances, I think I can get away with it." "Ruth was loved in Haven, which is a fact I don't think I have to tell you. Most of the town will turn out to see her into the ground. I don't know if they still loved her when she died, but that don't matter. They'll turn out anyway."
"How do you figure that?" Dugan asked. "Or is that another one of those things you don't want to talk about?"
"No, I don't mind. It would look wrong if they didn't turn out."
"To who?"
"To you. To the other policemen who were friends to her and her husband. To the Pauls from the Penobscot County Democratic Committee.
Why, 'twouldn't surprise me if Congressman Brennan sent someone up from Augusta. She worked awful hard for him when he ran for office in Washington. She wasn't just local, you see. That's part of what they got to deal with. They're like people who don't want to throw a party, but who are stuck doing it just the same. I'm hoping they'll be so busy making things look right, with putting on a good show, that they'll not even know I've been in Haven until I'm gone."
Butch Dugan crossed his arms over his chest. Ev had been close to the truth. At first, Dugan had indulged himself in the fancy that David Bright, who was usually an accurate interpreter of human behavior, had been wrong this time. Hillman was as sane as he was. Now he was mildly disturbed, not because Hillman had turned out to be crazy after all, but because he had turned out to be really crazy. And yet, there was something oddly persuasive in the old man's calm, reasonable voice and his steady gaze.
"You speak as if everyone in Haven was in on something," Dugan said.
"And I think that's impossible. I want you to know that."
"Yes, any normal person would say that. That's how they've been able to get away with it this long. 50 years ago, people felt like the atomic bomb was impossible, and they would have laughed at the idea of TV, let alone a video recorder."
"Not much changes, Trooper Dugan. Most people see as far as the horizon, and that's all. If someone says there's something over it, people don't listen."
Ev stood up and extended his hand over Dugan's desk, as if he had every right in the world to expect Dugan to shake it, which surprised Butch into doing just that.
"Well, I knew when I looked at you that you thought I was nuts," Ev said with a rueful little smile, "and I guess I've said enough to double that idea. But I found out what I needed to know and said what I needed to say. I'll do an old man a favor and peek at the sky once in a while. If you see a purple star shell—"
"The woods are dry this summer," Dugan said, and even as the woods came out of his mouth they seemed helpless and oddly unimportant, almost frivolous. He realized he was being drawn helplessly toward belief again. Dugan cleared his throat and pushed on. "If you've really got a flare gun, using it could start a hell of a forest fire. If you don't have a permit to use such a thing, and I know goddamn well you don't, it could get you thrown into jail."
Ev's grin widened a little, but there was still no humor in it.
"If you see the star shell," he said, "I got a feeling that being thrown into the pokey up to Bangor is going to be the least of my worries."
"Good day to you, Trooper Dugan."
Ev stepped out and closed the door neatly behind him. Dugan stood for a moment, as perplexed and uneasy as he had ever been in his life.
Let him go, he thought, and then got moving. Something had been troubling Butch Dugan. The disappearance of the two troopers, both of whom he had known and liked, had temporarily driven it out of his mind. Hillman's visit had brought it back, and that was what sent him after the old man. It was the memory of his last conversation with Ruth. He had been worried about her even before then. Her handling of the David Brown search hadn't been like the Ruth McCausland he knew at all. For the only time he could remember, she had been unprofessional. Then, the night before she died, he had called her about the investigation, to get information and to give it. To Kibitz, in short. He knew neither of them had anything, but sometimes you could spin something out of plain speculation, like straw into gold. In the course of that conversation, the subject of the boy's grandfather had come up. By then, Butch had spoken to David Bright of the news, had had a beer with him, in fact, and passed on to Ruth Ev's idea that the whole town had gone crazy in some strange way. Ruth hadn't laughed at the story, or clucked over the failure of Ev Hillman's mind, as he had expected she would do. He wasn't sure just what she had said, because just about then the connection had begun to get bad. Not that there was anything very unusual in that. Most of the lines going into small towns like Haven were still on poles and the connections regularly went to hell. All it took was a high wind to make you feel like you and the other person were holding tomato soup cans connected by a length of wax string. "Better tell him to stay away," Ruth had said. He was sure of that much. And then, just before he lost her altogether, it seemed to him that she had sent something about, of all things, nylon stockings. He must have heard her wrong, but there was no mistaking the tone, sadness and great weariness, as if her failure to find David Brown had taken all the heart out of her. A moment later the connection had broken down completely. He hadn't bothered to call her back because he had given her all the information he had. Precious little, really. The next day she was dead. Better tell him to stay away. That much he was sure of. Now I have reasons to believe that I'm not wanted in Haven. Tell him to stay away. I might disappear like David Brown. Stay away. Or have an accident like Ruth McCausland. Away. He caught up to the old man in the parking lot. 14. Hillman had an old purple Valiant with badly rusted rocker panels. He looked up, driver's side door open, as Dugan loomed over him. I'm coming with you tomorrow. Ev's eyes widened. You don't even know where I'm going. No, but if I'm with you, I won't have to worry that you're going to set half the woods in eastern Maine on fire trying to send me a message like 007. Ev looked at him consideringly, and then shook his head. I'd feel better having someone with me, he said, especially a guy as big as Gorilla Monsoon who packs a gun. But they ain't stupid in Haven, Officer Dugan. They never were, and I got a feeling that they're a lot less stupid just lately. They expect to see you at her funeral. If they don't, they're going to be suspicious. Christ, I'd like to know how the hell you can stand there babbling all that crazy shit and sound so fucking sane. Maybe because you know, too, Ev said. How funny it is. How funny all these things started in Haven. Then, with a prescience that was startling, he added, Or maybe you knew Ruth well enough yourself to sense she'd gotten off kilter. The two men stood looking at each other in the graveled parking lot of the Dairy Barracks, the sun beating down on them, their shadows, clear and black, slanting out neatly at 2 o'clock. I'll let on tonight that I'm sick, Dugan said, that I've got stomach flu. It's been going around the barracks. What do you think? Ev nodded with sudden relief. That relief was so great it was startling. The idea of sneaking back into Haven had frightened him more than he had been willing to let on, especially to himself. He had half convinced this big cop that something might be going on there. He could see it in his face. Half convinced wasn't much, maybe, but it was still a giant step forward from where he had been. And, of course, he hadn't done it alone. Ruth McCausland had helped. All right, he said. But listen to me, Trooper Dugan, and listen good. because our lives could depend on it tomorrow. Don't you call up any of the men who'll be going to the funeral tomorrow and tell them the reason you're not going to be there is just a gag you're running. Call up a few people tonight and tell them you really are just as sick as a dog, that you hope you're going to be able to make it, but you doubt it.
Dugan frowned. Well, why would you want me to say?
But suddenly he knew, and his mouth dropped open. The old man stared back at him calmly enough.
Christ Jesus, are you telling me that you think the people in Haven are mind readers? That if my men knew I really wasn't sick, the people in town could pick the news right out of their heads?
I ain't telling you a thing, Trooper Dugan, Ev said. You are telling me.
Mr. Hillman, I really think you must be imagining. I never expected you'd want to come with me when I came to see you. I wasn't angling for it, either. The most I hoped for was that you'd keep an eye out and see my flare if I got in trouble. And that would at least keep the heat on that nest of snakes down there a while longer. But if you offer a man more, he wants more.
Trust me a little further, please, for Ruth's sake. If that's what it takes to convince you to come with me, I'm willing to use it. Something else. No matter what, you're going to feel some peculiar things tomorrow.
I felt some pretty peculiar ones today, Dugan said.
I am,
Ev said, and waited for Dugan to decide. Do you have some actual place to go in mind? Dugan asked after a moment. Or are you just going to ramble around the town until you get tired of it?
I've got a place in mind, Ev said quietly. He thought, oh, yes. Yes, sirree, Bob. Up behind the old Garrick place on the outskirts of Big Injun Woods, where compasses have never worked worth a tin shit in a gold mine. And I believe we'll strike on a pretty good path through the woods to it, whatever it is, because equipment like the stuff Bobby Anderson and a friend have been using leaves a back trail as wide as a freeway. No, I don't believe there will be any trouble finding it at all.
Okay. Give me the address of the place you're staying in Derry, and I'll pick you up at 9 in my personal car. We'll get to Haven just about the time the service starts.
The car's my treat, Ev said quietly.
Not this one. It's known in Haven. I'll have a rental. And you'll want to show up at 8, because we'll be doing a bit of back roading.
I can get us into Haven and still keep clear of the village, Dugan said. You don't have to worry about that.
I ain't. But I want us to skirt the whole town and come in from the Albion side, and I think I know just the way to do it.
Why the hell does it have to be that end of town?
Because it's the furthest from where they'll be, and that's where I want to come back into Haven, as far from them as I can get.
You're really scared, aren't you?
Ev nodded.
Why a rental car?
Criminy, don't you ask a lot of questions.
And Ev rolled his eyes in such a comical way that Butch Dugan grinned.
It's my job, he said. Why do you want to go on a rental?
No one in Haven is going to know my personal car. He paused, thinking. At least, not now that Ruth's dead.
Because it's my obsession, Ev Hillman said.
His face suddenly cracked into a smile of startling sweetness.
And a person ought to pay the freight on his own obsession.
All right, Butch said. I give up. 8 o'clock, your route, your car, your obsession.
I must be crazy. I really must be.
By tomorrow at this time, I think you're going to have a much better idea of what crazy is, Ev said, and climbed into his old purple Valiant before Dugan could ask him any more questions. Butch, in fact, had no more questions to ask. He felt glum, as if he had bought the Brooklyn Bridge his first day in New York City, shelling out even though he knew a thing that big probably couldn't be for sale.
No one gets taken who doesn't want to be taken, he thought.
He had worked fraud and bunco out of Augusta for 3 years, and that was the first thing they taught you. The old man had been queerly persuasive. But Butch Dugan knew that he had not been persuaded into this. He had jumped. Because he had loved Ruth McCausland, and in another year or so, he probably would have plucked up sufficient nerve to propose to her.
because when someone you love dies, it leaves a black hole in the middle of your heart. And one way to plug such a hole is to refuse to admit that he or she was taken away by a stupid mischance. Better if you can believe, even for a little while, that someone or something you can get hold of was responsible. It makes the hole a little smaller. Even a rube knows that much. Sighing, suddenly feeling much older than his age, Dugan trudged back to the barracks. Ev went to the hospital and sat for most of that day's remainder with Hilly. Around 3 o'clock he wrote 2 notes. One he put on Hilly's night table, anchored against the breeze that pawed with occasional playfulness through the open window with a little pot of flowers. The other note was longer, and when he had done with it, he folded it and put it in his pocket. Then he left the hospital. He drove to a small building in the Derry Industrial Park. Maine Med Supplies, the sign over the door read, and below that, specializing in respiration supplies and respiration therapy since 1946. He told the man inside what he wanted. The man told him it sounded as if he really ought to take a ride up to Bangor and talk to the folks at Down East Scuba Dive. Ev explained that a scuba tank was the last thing he wanted. He was interested in as much dry land portability as he could get. He and the fellow talked a while longer, and Ev left after signing a 36-hour rental agreement with a rather specialized piece of equipment. The fellow at Maine Med Supplies stood at the door watching him go, scratching his head. 15. The nurse read the note by Hilly's bed. Hilly, I may not see you for a while now, but I just wanted to tell you I think you'll get over this bad patch, and if I can help you do it, I guess I will be just about the happiest grandpa in the world. I believe David is still alive, and I don't think it's your fault that he got lost in the first place. I love you, Hilly, and I hope to see you soon. Gramp. But he never saw Hilly Brown again. Chapter 9. The Funeral. 1. From 9 o'clock on, out-of-towners who had known or worked with Ruth McCausland began to come into Haven Village. Soon, almost every parking space along Main Street was taken. The Haven Lunch did a brisk business. Beach kept busy, short-ordering eggs, bacon, sausages, and home fries. He brewed pot after pot of coffee. Representative Brennan hadn't come, but he had sent a close aide. "Should have come yourself, Joe," Beach thought, with a little sunken smile. "Might have got a whole slew of new ideas about how to run the government." The day dawned brisk and clear, more like late September than late July. The sky was bright blue, the temperature a moderate 68 degrees, the wind out of the west at about 20 miles an hour. Once more there were outsiders in Haven, and once more Haven had gotten lucky weather for them. And soon it wouldn't matter whether they were lucky or not, the townsfolk told each other without speaking. Soon they would be in charge of their own luck. A good day, you would have said. The best kind of New England summer's day, the sort the tourists come for. A day to prick the appetite fully alive. Those who came to Haven from out of town ordered hearty breakfasts, as people with lively appetites are apt to do, but Beach noted that most of those breakfasts came back only half-eaten. The newcomers lost their appetites quickly. The light went out of their eyes, and they began to look, for the most part, shallow and a little sick. The lunch was crowded, but conversation lagged. "Must be the air here in our little town don't quite agree with you folks," Beach thought. He imagined going into the storeroom, where the device he had used to get rid of the 2 nosy cops was hidden under a pile of tablecloths. He imagined bringing it out here, a great big deadly bazooka, and just washing his lunchroom clean of all these outsiders with a purifying blast of green fire. No, not now. Not yet. Soon it wouldn't matter. Next month. But for now. He looked down at the plate he was scraping and saw a tooth in someone's scrambled eggs. "Tommyknocker's coming, my friends," Beach thought. "Only when they finally get here, I don't think they'll even bother knocking. I think they'll just blow the fucking door right down." Beach's grin widened. He scraped the tooth off the plate with the rest of the garbage. 2. Dugan could be silent when he wanted, and this morning that was what he wanted. Apparently, it was what the old man wanted, too. Dugan had gotten to Ev Hillman's apartment building on Lower Main promptly at 8, and had found a Jeep Cherokee standing at the curb behind the old party's Valiant. There was a big gunny sack in the back, its top tied with hay rope.
"Did you rent this in Bangor?"
"Leased it at Derry, AMC," Ev said.
"Must have been expensive."
"'Twasn't too dear." That ended the conversation. They arrived somewhere near the Albion Haven town line an hour and 40 minutes later. "We'll be doing a bit of back roading," the old man had said, and if that wasn't a classic understatement, Butch didn't know what was. He had been driving in this part of Maine for almost 20 years, and before today had thought he knew it like the back of his hand. Now he knew better. Hillman knew it like the back of his hand. By comparison, Butch Dugan had a general working knowledge of the area, no more. They went from the turnpike to Route 69, from 69 to two-lane blacktop, then to gravel in western Troy, then to hardpan, then to rutted dirt with grass growing up the middle, finally to an overgrown logging track that looked as if it might have last been seriously used around 1950.
"Do you know where the fuck you're going?"
Butch shouted as the Cherokee crashed through rotted corduroy, then hauled itself out, engine howling, all four wheels spinning up mud and chewed splinters. Ev only nodded. He clung to the Cherokee's big wheel like an old balding monkey. One woods road led into another, and finally they crashed out of a scree of foliage and onto a dirt road Butch recognized as Albion Town Road Number 5. Butch had thought it impossible, but the old man had done exactly what he promised, brought them all the way around Haven without ever once going in. Now Ev brought the Cherokee to a stop just 100 feet short of the marker, announcing the Haven town line. He turned off the engine and unrolled his window. There was no sound but the tick of the engine. There was no bird song, and Butch thought this odd.
"What's in that gunny sack back there?" Butch asked.
"All kinds of things. No need to worry about it now."
"What are you waiting for?"
"Church bells," Ev said.
3. It was not the Methodist church bells that Ev had grown up with and expected, which rang out at 9:45, calling Ruth's mourners, both the real ones and those prepared to shed copious floods of crocodile tears, to the Methodist church, where the first act of the three-act festivities was to be played out. Act 2, graveside ceremonies. Act 3, refreshments in the town library. Reverend Gooringer, a shy man who usually had not the fortitude to say boo to a goose, had gone around town a few weeks ago telling people he was getting damn tired of all that gonging.
"Then why don't you do something about it, Gooey?"
Pamela Sargent asked him. Reverend Lester Gooringer had never been called Gooey in his entire life, but in his current state of rancor he barely noticed it.
"Maybe I will," he said, looking at her through his thick glasses grimly. "Just maybe I will."
"Got any ideas?"
"I might," he said slyly. "Time'll tell, won't it?"
"It always does, Gooey," she said. "Always does."
The Reverend Gooringer, in fact, had a fine idea about those bells. He could hardly believe it had never occurred to him before. It was so simple and beautiful. And the best thing about it was that he wouldn't have to take it up with the deacons, or with the Ladies' Aid, an organization which apparently attracted only 2 types of women, fat slobs with boobs the size of barrels, and skinny-assed, flat-chested sluts like Pamela Sargent with her fake ivory cigarette holder and her raspy smoker's cough, or with the few well-to-do members of his congregation. Going to them always gave him a week's worth of acid indigestion. He did not like to beg. No, this was something the Reverend Lester Gooringer could do all by himself. And so he did it. Fuck 'em if they couldn't take a joke.
"And if you ever call me Gooey again, Pam,"
he had whispered as he rewired the fuse box in the church basement so it could handle the heavy voltage his idea would require,
"I'll jam the plumber's friend in the parsonage pissoir up your twat and plunge out your brains if you haven't pissed them all away.
He cackled and went on rewiring. Reverend Lester Gooringer had never had such blunt thoughts or said such blunt things in his life, and he found the experience liberating and exhilarating. He was, in fact, prepared to tell anyone in Haven who didn't like his new Carillon that they could take a flying fuck at a rolling doughnut. But everyone in town had thought the change nothing short of magnificent. It was, too. And today the Reverend Gooringer felt a real heart swell of pride as he flicked the new switch in the vestry and the sound of the bells floated out over Haven, playing a medley of hymns. The Carillon was programmable, and today Lester Gooringer plugged in the hymns which had been particular favorites of Ruth's. They included such old Methodist and Baptist standbys as "What a Friend We Have in Jesus" and "This Is My Father's World." The Reverend Gooringer stood back, rubbing his hands together, and watched as people began to move toward the church in groups and twos and threes, drawn by the bells, the bells, the calling of the bells.
"Hot damn!" the Reverend Gooringer exclaimed. He had never felt better in his life, and he meant to send Ruth McCausland off in style. He intended to preach one pie-cutter of a eulogy. After all, they had all loved her.
4. The Bells. Dave Rutledge, Haven's oldest citizen, tipped an ear toward them and smiled toothlessly. Even if the bells had jangled discordantly, he would have smiled because he could hear them. Until early July, Dave had been almost completely deaf, and his lower limbs were always cold as his circulation steadily failed. He was, after all, 90, and that made him an old dog. But this month, his hearing and circulation had magically improved. People told him he looked 10 years younger, and by Christ he felt 20 years younger. And my, wasn't the sound of those bells playing just the sweetest thing? Dave got up and started toward the church.
5. The Calling of the Bells.
In January, the aide U.S. Representative Brennan had sent to Haven had been in D.C., and there he had met a beautiful young woman named Annabelle. This summer she had come to Maine to be with him, and had come to Haven with him this morning to keep him company. He had promised her they would overnight in Bar Harbor before going back to Augusta. At first she thought it had been a bad idea, because she began to feel a little nauseated in the restaurant, and hadn't been able to finish her breakfast. For one thing, the short-order cook looked like an older, fatter version of Charles Manson. He kept smiling the strangest little smile when he thought no one was looking. It was enough to make you wonder if he had powdered the scrambled eggs with arsenic. But the sound of the bells chiming hymns she hadn't heard since her Nebraska childhood charmed her with wonder.
"My God, Marty, how can a little wide place in the road town like this afford a gorgeous Carillon like that?"
Maybe some rich summer tourist died and left it to them," Marty said vaguely. He had no interest in the Carillon. He'd had a headache ever since they got here, and was getting worse. Also, one of his gums was bleeding. Pyorrhea ran in his family. He hoped to God it wasn't that. "Come on, let's go over to the church, so we can get it done and go up to Bar Harbor and screw our brains out," he thought. "This is one creepy little town." They started across the street together, she in a black suit, but she told him archly on their way up, her underwear was all white silk. What little of it there was. He in a governmental charcoal gray. The people of Haven, dressed in their soberest finery, walked with them. Marty saw a surprising number of powder blue state police uniforms.
"Look, Marty, the clock."
She was pointing at the tower of the town hall. It was good, solid red brick, but for a moment it seemed to swim and waver before Marty's eyes. His headache was instantly worse. Maybe it was eye strain. He'd had a checkup 3 months ago, and the guy had said his vision was good enough to fly a jet, but maybe he'd been wrong. Half the professional people in America were on coke these days. He had read all about it in Time. And why was his mind wandering like this anyway? It was the bells. They seemed to be echoing and multiplying in his head. 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, all playing, "When We Meet at Jesus' Feet."
What about the clock? He asked irritably.
The hands are funny, she said. They look almost drawn on.
6. The Calling of the Bells. Eddie Stampnell of the Dairy Barracks crossed the street with Andy Rideout from Orono. Both of them had known Ruth, liked her.
Pretty, ain't it?
Eddie asked dubiously.
Maybe, Andy said. I just keep thinking of Bent and Jingles getting blown away by a couple of numbnut rubes out here, probably buried in some farmer's potato field, and it just sounds like a bone phone to me. Seems like Haven's bad luck now. I know that's stupid, but that's how I feel.
It's bad luck for my head, Eddie replied. It aches like a bastard.
Well, let's get it over and get out, Andy said. She was a good woman, but she's gone. Between you and me, I don't care if I never spend another 15 minutes in Haven now that she is.
They stepped into the Methodist church together, neither of them looking at Reverend Lester Gooringer, who stood beside the switch which controlled his lovely carillon, smiling and rubbing his dry hands together and accepting the compliments of all and sundry.
7. The Crying of the Bells.
Bobby Anderson got out of her blue Chevrolet truck, slamming the door, smoothing her dark blue dress over her hips, and checking her makeup in the truck's outside mirror, before walking slowly down the sidewalk to the church. She walked with her head down and her shoulders slumped. She was trying hard to get the rest she needed to go on, and Guard had helped to put a brake on her obsession.
And that's what it is, an obsession. No use kidding yourself.
But Guard was a break that was slowly wearing out. He wasn't at the funeral because he was sleeping off a monumental drunk, his grizzled, worn face pillowed on one arm, his breath a sour cloud around him. Anderson was tired all right, but it was more than just that. A great, unfocused grief seemed to fill her this morning. It was partly for Ruth, partly for David Brown, partly for the whole town. Yet mostly, she suspected, it was for herself. The becoming continued. For everyone in Haven except Guard, that was. And it was good. But she mourned her own unique identity, which was now fading like a morning mist. She knew now that The Buffalo Soldiers was her last book. And the irony was that she now suspected the Tommyknockers had written most of that as well.
8. The bells, bells, bells.
Haven answered them. It was Act One of a charade titled The Burial of Ruth McCausland, or How We Loved That Woman. Nancy Voss had closed the post office to come. The government would not have approved, but what the government didn't know wouldn't hurt them. They would know plenty soon enough, she thought. They would get a big old express mail delivery from Haven very soon. Them and every other government on this flying mudball. Frank Spruce, Haven's biggest dairy farmer, answered the bells. John Mumphrey, whose father had run against Ruth for the position of town constable, answered them. Ashley Ruval, who had passed her out by the town line 2 days before her death, answered them with his parents. Ashley was crying. Doc Warwick was there, and Judd Tarkington. Adley McKean came with Hazel McCready on his arm. Newt Barringer and Dick Allison answered them, walking slowly and supporting Ruth's predecessor, John Harley, between them. John was feeble and nearly transparent. Maggie, his wife, was not well enough to attend. They came, answering the summons of the bells, Tremaines and Thurlows, Applegates and Goldmans, Duplessis and Archenborgs. Good Maine people, you would have said, drawn from a healthy stockpot that was mostly French, Irish, Scots, and Canadian. But they were different now. As they drew together at the church, so did their minds draw together and become one mind, watching the outsiders, listening for the slightest wrong note in their thoughts. They came together, they listened, and the bells rang in their strange blood.
9.
Ev Hillman sat up behind the wheel of the Cherokee, eyes opening wide at the dim sound of the carillon.
What in the hell?
Church bells, what else? Butch Dugan said. Sounds very pretty. They're getting ready to start the funeral, I suppose.
They're burying Ruth over in the village. What in God's name am I doing out here by the town line with this crazy old man?
He wasn't sure, but it was too late to change his course now.
The bells of the Methodist church never made a sound like that before in my time, Ev said. Someone's changed them over.
So what?
So nothing. So everything. I don't know.
Come on, Trooper Dugan.
He turned the key and the Cherokee's engine roared.
I'll ask you again, Dugan said with what he thought was extraordinary patience. What are we looking for?
I don't rightly know.
The Cherokee passed the town line marker. They had left Albion now and entered Haven. Ev had a sudden sickening premonition that in spite of all his precautions and care, he was never going to leave it again.
We'll know it when we see it.
Dugan didn't reply, only held on for dear life and wondered again how he had gotten into this. He had to be as crazy as the old fart he was riding with, and then some. He raised one hand to his forehead and began rubbing, just above the eyebrows. A headache was forming there.
10. There were sniffles, red eyes, and some sobbing as Reverend Gooringer, his bald head gleaming mellowly and in a soft variety of colors, courtesy of the summer sunshine, falling through the stained-glass windows, launched into his funeral eulogy following a hymn, a prayer, another hymn, a reading of Ruth's favorite scripture, the Beatitudes, and yet another hymn. Below him, foaming around the lectern in a semicircle, were great bunches of summer flowers. Even with the upper windows of the church thrown open and a good breeze blowing through, their smell was suffocatingly sweet.
"We have come here to praise Ruth McCausland and to celebrate her passing," Gooringer began.
The townsfolk sat with hands either folded or gripping handkerchiefs. Their eyes, most wet, regarded Gooringer with sober, studious attention. They looked healthy, these folk. Their color was good, their skin for the most part unblemished, and even someone who had never been in Haven before could have seen that the congregation here fell naturally into two groups. The outsiders didn't look healthy. They were pale. Their eyes were dazed. Twice during the eulogy, people left hurriedly, dashed around the corner of the church, and were quietly sick. For others, the nausea was a lower complaint, an uneasy rolling in the bowels, not quite serious enough to cause an exit, but simply going on and on. Several outsiders would lose teeth before that day was over. Several developed headaches which would dissolve almost as soon as they left town. The aspirin finally working, they would surmise. And more than a few of them had the most amazing ideas as they sat on the hard pews and listened to Gooringer preach Ruth McCausland's eulogy. In some cases these ideas came so suddenly and seemed so huge, so fundamental, that the persons to whom they occurred would feel as if they had been shot in the head. Such persons had to fight down an urge to bolt out of their pews and run into the street screaming Eureka at full volume. The people of Haven saw this happening and were amused. All of a sudden the apathetic pudding-like expression on someone's face would be shocked away, the eyes would widen, the mouth flop open, and the Havenites would recognize the expression of a person in the throes of a grand idea. Eddie Stempnell, of the Derry Barracks, for instance, conceived of a nationwide police band on which every cop in the land could communicate, and he saw how a cloak could easily be thrown over such a band. All those nosy civilians with their police band radios would be shit out of luck, would be shit out of luck. Ramifications and modifications poured into his mind faster than he could deal with them. If ideas had been water, he would have drowned. "I'm going to be famous for this," he thought feverishly. Reverend Gooringer was forgotten. Andy Rideout, his partner, was forgotten. His dislike of this goofy little town was forgotten. Ruth was forgotten. The idea had swallowed his mind. "I'm going to be famous, and I'm going to revolutionize police work in America. Maybe in the whole world. Holy shit. Holy shit!"
The Havenites, who knew Eddie's great idea would be foggy by noon and gone by three, smiled and listened and waited. Waited for it to be over, so they could get back to their real business. So they could get back to becoming. 11. They rolled down a dirt track, Town Road No. 5 in Albion, which became Fire Road No. 16 here in Haven. Twice logging roads branched off into the woods, and each time one of these came up, Dugan braced himself for an even more bone-wrenching ride. But Hillman didn't take either. He reached Route 9 and swung right. He cranked the Cherokee up to 50 and headed deeper into Haven. Dugan was skittery. He didn't know exactly why. The old man was crazy, of course. The idea that Haven had turned into a nest of snakes was pure paranoia. All the same, Monster felt a steady, pulsing nervousness growing inside him. It was vague, a low grass fire in his nerves.
"You keep rubbing your forehead," Hillman said.
"I've got a headache.
It'd ache a lot worse if the wind wasn't blowing, I guess."
Another lapse into utter nonsense. What in God's name was he doing here, and why did he feel so goddamn jumpy?
"I feel like somebody slipped me a couple of sleeping pills."
"Hiya?"
Dugan looked at him.
"But you don't feel that way, do you? You're as cool as a goddamn cucumber." "I'm scared, but I don't have the jitters, and I don't have a headache, neither."
"Why would you have a headache?" Dugan asked crossly. The conversation had gotten decidedly Alice in Wonderland-ish. "Headaches aren't catching."
"If you and six other guys are painting a closed room, you are all apt to end up with headaches. Ain't that a true fact?"
"Yeah, I guess so, but this isn't..."
"No, it ain't. And we got lucky with the weather. Just the same, I guess that thing is putting out a powerful stink, because you feel it."
"I can see you do."
Hillman paused and then said another Alice in Wonderland thing.
"Had any good ideas yet, Trooper?"
"What do you mean?"
Hillman nodded, satisfied.
"Good. If you do, tell me. I got something in that sack for you."
"This is crazy," Dugan said. His voice wasn't quite steady.
"I mean, utterly nuts. Turn this thing around, Hillman. I want to go back."
Ev suddenly focused a single phrase in his mind, as sharply and as clearly as he could. He knew from his last 3 days in Haven that Bryant, Marie, Hilly, and David were routinely reading each other's minds. He could sense it, even though he couldn't pick it up. By the same token, he had come to realize they couldn't get into his head unless he let them. He had begun to wonder if it had something to do with the steel in his skull, a souvenir of that German grenade. He had seen the potato masher with dreadful, ineluctable clarity, a gray-black thing spinning in the snow. He thought, "Well, I'm dead. That's it for me." After, he remembered nothing until he'd awakened in a French hospital. He remembered how his head had hurt. He remembered the nurse who had kissed him, and how her breath had smelt like anise, and how she kept saying, shaping her words as if speaking to a very small child, "Je t'aime, mon amour. La guerre est finie. Je t'aime. Je t'aime, les États-Unis." La guerre est finie, he thought now. La guerre est finie.
"What is it?"
he asked Dugan sharply.
"What do you m—"
Ev swerved the Cherokee over the side of the road, kicking up a spume of dust. They were a mile and a half over the town line now. It was another 3 or 4 miles to the old Garrick farm.
"Don't think, don't talk, just tell me what I was thinking."
"Too finie. You're thinking, la guerre est finie. But you're crazy. People can't read minds. They ca—"
Dugan stopped. He turned his head slowly and stared at Ev. Ev could hear the tendons in the man's neck creak. His eyes were huge.
"La guerre est finie," he whispered. "That's what you were thinking.
And that she smelled like licorice."
"Anise,"
Ev said and smiled. Her thighs had been white. Her cunt so tight.
"And I saw a grenade in the snow. Oh, Jesus, what's going on?"
Ev pictured a red, old-fashioned tractor in his mind.
"What now?"
"Tractor," Dugan husked. "Farm ore. But you got the wrong tires on it. My dad had a farm ore. Those are Dixie Field Boss tires. They wouldn't fit a fa—"
Dugan suddenly turned around, grappled for the Cherokee's door handle, leaned out, and threw up. 12.
Ruth once asked me if I would read the Beatitudes at her funeral, if it should fall to me to preside over it.
The Reverend Gooringer was saying in a mellow Methodist voice the Reverend Donald Hartley would have completely approved of.
"And I have honored her wishes. Yet—"
"Laguerre, you were thinking—" "Laguerre asked—"
Gooringer paused, a little expression of surprise and concern touching his face. A close observer might have thought a little gas had bubbled up, and he had paused to stifle an unseemly burp.
"I think there is another set of verses she merits. They—"
"Tractor. Farm all tractor."
There was another small hitch in Gooringer's delivery, and that frown touched his face again.
Not the sort of verses, I suppose, that any Christian woman would dare ask for, knowing that a Christian woman must earn them. Listen as I read from the Book of Proverbs, and see if you, who knew her, do not agree that this is the case with Ruth McCausland."
"Those are Dixie Field Boss tires."
Dick Allison glanced to his left and caught Newt's eye across the aisle. Newt looked dismayed. John Harley's mouth had dropped open. His faded blue eyes shifted back and forth in bewilderment. Gooringer found his place, lost it, almost dropped his Bible. Suddenly he was flustered, no longer the master of ceremonies but a divinity student with stage fright. As it happened, no one noticed. The outsiders were occupied either with physical distress or with mind-boggling ideas. The people of Haven drew together as an alarm went off, jumping from one mind to the next until their heads rang with it. This was a new carillon, one that jangled with discord.
"Someone's looking where they have no business."
Bobby Tremaine took Stephanie Coulson's hand and squeezed it. She squeezed back, looking at him with wide brown eyes, the alarmed eyes of a doe who hears the slide and click of the bolt in a hunter's gun.
"Out on Route 9, too close to the ship. One's a cop. Cop, yes, but a special cop. Ruth's cop. He loved—"
Ruth would have known these rising voices. And now even some of the outsiders began to feel them, although they were relatively new to Haven's infection. A few of them looked around like people coming out of thin dozes. One of these was the lady friend of Representative Brennan's aide. She had been miles from here, it seemed. She was a minor bureaucrat in Washington, but she had just conceived of a filing system that might well get her a fat promotion. Then a random thought, a thought she would have sworn was not her own.
"Somebody's got to stop them, quick,"
slashed across her mind, and she looked around to see if someone had actually called out aloud in the church. But it was quiet, except for the preacher, who had found his place again. She looked at Marty, but Marty was sitting in a glassy daze, looking at one of the stained-glass windows with the fixed gaze of one deeply hypnotized. She supposed this to be boredom, and went back to her own thoughts.
"Who can find a virtuous woman?" Gooringer read,
his voice a trifle uneven. He hesitated in the wrong places and stumbled a few times.
"For her price is far above rubies. The heart of a husband doth safely trust in her, and he shall have no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool."
Now another burst of those alien thoughts came to the single sensitized ear in the church.
"Sorry about that, I just couldn't—"
"What?"
"Holy Christ, that's Wheeling. How—" "There are two voices speaking, but we are only hearing one,"
the mind net thought, and eyes began to focus on Bobby. There was only one person in Haven who could make his mind opaque to them, and that person wasn't here now.
Two voices. Is the one we don't hear the voice of your drunken friend?
Bobby got up suddenly and worked her way along the pew, horribly aware that people were looking at her. Gooringer, the ass, had paused again.
"Excuse me," Bobby muttered. "Excuse me, excuse me."
At last she escaped into the vestibule and the street. Others, Bobby Tremaine, Newt, Dick, and Bryant Brown among them, began to follow. None of the outsiders noticed. They had lapsed back into their strange dreams. 13.
"Sorry about that," Butch Dugan said.
He pulled the door closed, got a handkerchief out of his back pocket, and began to rub his mouth.
"I couldn't seem to help it. I feel better now."
Ev nodded.
"I ain't going to explain. There isn't time. But I want you to listen to something."
"What?"
Ev snapped on the Cherokee's radio and dialed across the band. Dugan started. He had never heard so many stations, not even at night when they jumped all over each other, wavering in and out in a sea of voices. Nothing wavering about these. Most were bell clear. Ev stopped at a C&W station. A song by the Judds was just ending. When it did, there was a station ID. Butch Dugan could hardly believe what he was hearing.
WWVA,
a perky girl group sang to an accompaniment of fiddles and banjos.
"Holy Christ, that's Wheeling," Dugan cried. "How?"
Ev snapped off the radio.
"Now I want you to listen to my head."
Dugan stared at him for a moment, utterly flummoxed. Not even Alice in Wonderland had been this mad.
"What in the name of God are you talking about?"
"Don't argue with me. Just do it."
Ev turned his face away from Dugan, presenting him with the back of his head.
"I got two pieces of steel plate in my head. War souvenir. Bigger one's back there. See the place where the hair don't grow?"
"Yes, but
time is short. Put your ear up close to that scar and listen."
He did, and felt unreality wash over him. The back of the old man's head was playing music. It was tinny and distant, but perfectly identifiable. It was Frank Sinatra singing "New York, New York." Butch Dugan began to giggle. Soon he was laughing. Then he was roaring, arms wrapped around his stomach. He was out here in the back of the beyond with an old man whose head had just turned into a music box. By God, this was better than Ripley's Believe It or Not. Butch laughed and gasped and wept and roared and— The old man's calloused palm slammed across his face. The shock of being slapped like a small child surprised Butch out of his hysteria as much as the pain had done. He blinked at Ev, one hand going to his cheek.
"It started a week and a half before I left town," Ev said grimly. "Blasts of music in my head. They were stronger when I got out this way, and I should have thought about that before now, but I didn't. They're stronger now. Everything is. So I got no time for you to get the scream in your horse. Are you going to be all right?"
The flush spreading over Dugan's face mostly hid the red mark Ev's hand had made. The screaming yaw-haws. That pretty well described it. First he had puked, and then he had had a fit of hysterics like a teenage girl. This old man wasn't just showing him up, he was pulling past him in second gear.
"I'll be fine," he said.
"You believe now there's something going on here? That something in Haven has changed?"
"Yes, I—" He swallowed. "Yes," he repeated.
"Good."
Ev stepped on the gas and roared back onto the road.
"This thing, it's changing everyone in town, Trooper Dugan. Everyone but me. I get music in my head, but that's all. I don't read minds, and I don't get ideas."
"What do you mean, ideas? What kind of ideas?"
"All kinds."
The Cherokee speedometer touched 60, then began to edge past it.
"Thing is, I have no proof of what's going on. None at all. You thought I was right off in my head, didn't you?"
Dugan nodded. He was holding on tight to the dashboard in front of him. He felt sick to his stomach again. The sun was too bright, dazzling on the windshield and the chrome.
The reporter and the nurses did, too. But there's something in the woods, and I'm going to find it. And I'm going to take some pictures of it, and I'm going to take you out, and we're going to do some loud talking, and maybe we'll find a way to get my grandson David back. And maybe we won't. But either way, we ought to be able to shut down whatever's going on here before it's too late. Ought to. We got to.
Now the speedometer needle hung just below 70.
How far?
Dugan managed through closed teeth. He was going to puke again, and soon. He just hoped he could hold on until they got to wherever they were going.
The old Garrick farm, Ev said. Less than a mile.
Thank God, Dugan thought. 14. It's not guard, Bobby said. Guards passed out on the porch of the house.
How do you know?
Adley McKean asked. You can't read 'em.
I can, though, Bobby said. A little more every day.
He's still on the porch, I tell you. He's dreaming about skiing. They looked at Bobby silently for a moment. About a dozen men standing across the street from the Methodist church in front of the Haven Lunch.
Who is it, then?
Joe Summerfield asked at last.
I don't know, Bobby said.
Only that it's not guard. Bobby was swaying mildly on her feet. Her face was that of a woman who was 50, not 37. There were brown circles of exhaustion under her eyes. The men seemed not to notice. From the church, voices were raised in Holy, Holy, We Adore Thee.
I know who it is, Dick Allison said suddenly.
His eyes had gone strange and dull with hate.
Only one other person it could be. Only one other person I know of in town with metal in his head.
Ev Hillman, Newt cried.
Christ!
We've got to get moving, Judd Tarkington said. The bastards are getting close. Adley, get some guns from the hardware store.
Okay.
Get 'em, but don't use 'em, Bobby said. Her eyes swept the men. Not on Hillman, if it's him, and not on the cop, particularly not on the cop. We can't afford another mess in Haven. Not before
the becoming.
It's all finished.
I'll get my tube, Beach said.
His face was vacant with eagerness. Bobby grabbed his shoulder.
No, you won't, she said. No more messes includes no more cops disappearing.
She looked at them all again, then at Dick Allison, who nodded.
Hillman's got to disappear, he said. No way around it. But that's maybe all right. Ev's crazy. Crazy old man might decide to do just about anything. A crazy old man might just decide to haul stakes and drive off to Zion, Utah, or Grand Forks, Idaho, to wait for the end of the world. The cop's going to make a mess, but he's going to make it in Derry, and it's going to be a mess everyone understands. No one else is going to shit in our nest. Go on, Judd, get the guns. Bobby, you pull in back of the lunch with your pickup truck. Newt, Adley, Joe, you ride with me. You go with Bobby, Judd. Rest of you, go in Kyle's caddy. Come on, hoss your freight. They got moving.
15.
Shh. Same old dream. A few new wrinkles. Damn strange ones. The snow had gone pink. It was soaked with blood. Was it coming from him? Holy hell. Who'd have believed how much blood the old tosspot had in him?
They are skiing the intermediate slope. He knows that he should have stayed on the beginner's slopes for at least one more session. This is too fast for him. And furthermore, all this bloody snow is very distracting, particularly when it's all your blood. Now he looks up, sending a rip of pain through his head, and his eyes widen. There's a jeep on the goddamn slope.
Anne-Marie screams, "Stem Bobby! Guard! Stem Bobby!"
But he doesn't need to stem Bobby, because this is just a dream. It's become an old friend in the last few weeks, like the erratic bursts of music in his head. This is a dream, and that isn't a jeep, and this isn't the straight arrow slope. It's turning into Bobby's driveway.
Is this a dream? Or is it real?
No, he realized, that was the wrong question. A better question would have been, how much of this is real? The chrome winked blinding arrows of light into Gardner's eyes. He winced and groped for,
ski poles?
No, not a dream. It's summer. You're in Haven. The porch railing. He could remember almost everything. It was hazy, but he could remember. No blackouts since he had come back to Bobby's. Music in his head, but no blackouts. Bobby had gone to a funeral. Later on, she'd come back and they would start digging again. He remembered it all, just as he remembered the town hall clock tower lifting off into the afternoon sky like a big-ass bird. All present and accounted for, sir. Except this. He stood with his hands on the railing, bleary, bloodshot eyes, watching the jeep in spite of the glare. He was aware that he must look like a refugee from the Bowery. Thank God there's still some truth in advertising. That's what I feel like. Then the man in the passenger seat turned his head and saw a guard. The man was so huge that he looked like a creature from a fairy tale. He was wearing sunglasses, so Gardner couldn't tell for sure if their eyes actually met or not. He thought they did. It felt that way. Either way, it didn't matter. He knew the look. As a veteran of 50 picket lines, he knew it well. He also knew it as a drunk who had awakened in the tank on more than one occasion. The Dallas police have arrived at last, he thought. The thought carried feelings of anger and regret, but what he felt mostly was relief. At least, for the moment. He's a cop. But what's he doing in a jeep? God, the size of his face. He's as big as a fucking house. Must be a dream. Must be. The jeep didn't stop. It rolled up the driveway and out of sight. Now Gardner could hear only its roaring motor. Headed out back, going up there in the woods. They knew all right. Oh, Christ, if the government gets it. All of his earlier dismay rose in him like bile. His dazed relief blew away like smoke. He saw Ted the Power Man throwing his jacket over the littered remains of the levitation machine and saying, "What gadget?" Dismay was replaced by the old sick fury. "Hey, Bobby, get your ass out here," he shrieked in his mind as loudly and clearly as he could. Fresh blood burst from his nose and he staggered weakly back, grimacing in disgust and groping for his handkerchief. "What does it matter, anyway? Let them have it. It's the devil on either hand, and you know it. So what if the Dallas police get it? It's turning Bobby and everyone in town into the Dallas police, particularly her company. The one she brings out late at night when she thinks I'm asleep, the one she takes into the shed." This had happened twice, both times around 3 in the morning. Bobby thought Gardner was sleeping heavily, a combination of hard work, too much booze, and Valium. The level of pills in the Valium bottle was going steadily down, that was true, but not because Gardner was swallowing them. Each night's pill was actually going down the toilet. Why this stealth? He didn't know. Any more than he knew why he had lied to Bobby about what he had seen on Sunday afternoon. Flushing a Valium tablet every night wasn't really lying, because Bobby hadn't asked him outright if he was taking them. She had simply looked at the decreasing level of the tablets and drawn an erroneous conclusion Gardner hadn't bothered to correct. Just as he had not bothered to correct her idea that he was sleeping heavily. In fact, he had been plagued by insomnia. No amount of drink seemed to put him under for long. The result was a kind of constant, muddled consciousness, across which thin gray veils of sleep were sometimes drawn, like unwashed stockings. The first time he had seen light splash across the wall of the guest room in the early hours of the morning, he had looked out to see a large Cadillac pulling into the driveway. He had looked at his watch and thought, "Must be the Mafia. Who else would show up at a farm way out in the woods in a caddy at 3 in the morning? But when the porch light went on, he had seen the vanity plate, Kyle 1, and doubted if even the Mafia went for vanity plates. Bobby had joined the 4 men and 1 woman who had gotten out. Bobby was dressed, but barefoot. Gardner knew 2 of the men, Dick Allison, head of the local volunteer fire department, and Kyle Archenborg, a local realtor who drove a fat-ass Cadillac. The 2 others were vaguely familiar. The woman was Hazel McCready. After a few moments, Bobby had led them to her back shed, the one with the big Krieg lock on the door. Gardner thought,
Maybe I ought to go out there, see what's going on.
Instead, he'd lain down again. He didn't want to go near the shed. He was afraid of it, of what might be in there. He had dozed off again. The next morning there had been no Caddy, no sign of Bobby's company. Bobby had, in fact, seemed more cheerful, more her old self on that morning, than at any time since Gardner had returned. He had convinced himself it was a dream, or perhaps something, not the DTs exactly, but close, that had crawled out of a bottle. Then, not four nights ago, Kyle One had arrived again. Those same people had gotten out, met with Bobby, and gone around to the shed. Guard collapsed into Bobby's rocking chair and felt for the bottle of scotch he had brought out here this morning. The bottle was there. Gardner raised it slowly, drank, and felt liquid fire hit his belly and spread. The sound of the jeep was fading now, like something in a dream. Perhaps that was all it had been. Everything seemed that way now. What was that line in the Paul Simon song? Yes, sir. Michigan. Weird ships buried in the ground. Jeep Cherokees and Cadillacs in the middle of the night. Drink enough, and it all faded into a dream. Except it's no dream. They're the take-charge people, those people who come in the Cadillac with the Kyle One plates, just like the Dallas police, just like good old Ted with his reactors. What kind of shot are you giving them, Bobby? How are you souping them up even more than the rest of the resident geniuses? The old Bobby wouldn't have pulled that kind of shit, but the new, improved Bobby does. And what's the answer to all of this? Is there one? Devils on every side, Gardner cried out grandly. He slugged back the last of the scotch and threw the bottle over the porch railing and into the bushes. Devils on every side, he repeated, and passed out. 16. That guy saw us, Butch said as the jeep bulled across Anderson's garden in a diagonal, knocking over huge cornstalks and sunflowers that towered high over the Cherokee's roof. I don't care, Ev said, wrestling the wheel. They emerged from the garden on the far side. The Cherokee's wheels rolled over a number of pumpkins that were coming to full growth amazingly early. Their hides were strangely pale, and when they burst they disclosed unpleasant fleshy pink interiors. If they don't know we're in town by now, then I'm wrong about everything. Look, didn't I tell you? A wide, rutted track wound into the woods. Ev bounced onto it. There was blood on his face, Dugan swallowed. It was hard. His head ached very badly now, and all the fillings in his teeth seemed to be vibrating very fast. His guts were churning again. And his shirt looked like somebody popped him one in the neck. Pull over. I'm going to be sick again. Ev jammed on the brakes. Dugan opened the door and leaned out, vomited a thin yellow stream into the dirt, and then closed his eyes for a moment. The world was swooping and turning. Voices rustled in his head, a great many voices. Guards saw them. He's yelling for help. How many? Two in a Cherokee. They were headed. Look, Butch heard himself say, as if from a great distance. I don't want to spoil the party, but I'm sick. Seriously sick. Thought you might be, Hillman's voice came down a long, echoing hall. Somehow Butch managed to haul himself up again in the passenger seat, but he didn't even have strength enough to pull the door closed. He felt as weak as a new kitten. You ain't had time to build up any resistance, and we're right where it's strongest. Hold on. I got something that'll fix you up. Least I think I do. Ev pushed the switch that lowered the Cherokee's electric rear window, got out, lowered the tailgate, and pulled out the gunny sack. He dragged it back to the jeep, and then hoisted it onto the seat. He glanced at Dugan, and didn't like what he saw. The trooper's face was the color of candle wax. His eyes were shut, the lids purplish. His mouth was half open, and he was breathing in quick, shallow gasps. Ev found a moment to wonder how whatever it was could be doing that to Dugan, when he himself felt nothing, absolutely nothing. "Hang on, friend," he said.
and used his pocket knife to cut the rope holding the neck of the bag.
"Sick,"
Dugan wheezed, and retched brownish fluid. Ev saw that there were three teeth in the mess. He got out a light plastic oxygen supply tank, what the clerk at Maine Med Supplies had called a flat pack. He stripped the gold foil circle from the end of the hose, leading out of the flat pack, revealing a stainless steel female connector. Now he brought out a gold-colored plastic cup, the sort jet airliners come equipped with. A segmented white plastic tube was attached to this, and at the end there was a white plastic male connector, a valve.
"This don't work the way the guy said it would. I do believe this big fellow's going to die on me."
He slammed the male connector of the mask into the female connector on the oxygen supply, violent intercourse which he hoped would result in keeping Dugan going. He heard oxygen sighing gently inside the gold cup. "All right, so far so good." He leaned over and put the cup over Dugan's mouth and nose, using the elastic straps. Then he waited anxiously to see what would happen. If Dugan didn't come out of his tailspin in 30 or 40 seconds, he would haul ass. David was missing and Hilly was sick, but neither thing gave him the right to murder Dugan, who hadn't known what sort of mess he was getting into. 20 seconds passed. Then 30. Ev dropped the Cherokee into reverse, meaning to turn around on the edge of Anderson's garden, when Dugan gasped, jerked, and opened his eyes. They looked very wide and blue and bewildered above the rim of the gold cup. Some color had come back into his cheeks.
"What the hell?"
His hands groped for the cup.
"Leave it on," Ev said,
putting one of his big, arthritis-warped old hands over one of Butch's.
"It was the outside air poisoning you. You in a hurry for another dose?"
Butch stopped reaching for the cup. It bobbed on his face as he said, "How long will this stuff last?" 25 minutes or so," the guy said. "It's a demand valve, though. Every now and then you can pull it down. When you start feeling woozy again, put it back on. I want to go on in, if you think you can. It can't be far, and I feel like I got to know."
Butch Dugan nodded.
The Cherokee lurched forward again. Dugan stared out at the woods around them.
Silent. No birds, no animals. No nothing.
This was very wrong. Very bad, and very damned wrong. Faintly, far back in his mind, he could hear thoughts like a whisper of shortwave transmissions. He looked at Ev.
"What the blue fuck is going on here, anyway?" "That's to find out."
Without taking his eyes off the rough track, Ev rummaged in the sack. Dugan winced as the Cherokee's undercarriage screamed over a stump sawed off a little higher than the others. Ev brought out a big .45. It looked old enough for its original owner to have carried it in World War I.
"Yours?" Dugan asked.
It was amazing how fast the oxygen was bringing him around.
"Yeah? They teach you to use these things, don't they?"
"Yes, although the one Hillman had looked like an antique."
"You might have to use it today," Ev said and handed it over.
"What? Have a care. It's loaded." Up ahead, the land suddenly sloped downward. Through the trees came a giant reflection, sunshine bouncing off a huge metal object. Ev stamped the brake, suddenly terrified to the depths of his heart.
"What the hell?"
he heard Dugan mutter beside him. Ev opened the door and got out. As his feet touched the ground, he became aware that the earth was crisscrossed with small, dusty cracks, and that it was vibrating very rapidly. At the next moment, music so loud it was deafening blew through his head at gale force. It went on for perhaps 30 seconds, but the pain was excruciating, and it seemed forever. At last, it simply winked out. He saw Dugan standing in front of the Cherokee, the cup now hooked under his chin. He held the flat pack by the strap in one hand, the .45 in the other. He was looking at Ev apprehensively.
"I'm all right," Ev said.
"Yeah? Your nose is bleeding. Just like that guy back at the farm we passed." Ev wiped his nose with his finger and looked at the smear of blood. He wiped his finger on his pants and nodded toward Dugan.
Remember to put the mask back on when you start feeling woozy.
Oh, don't worry.
Ev leaned back into the Cherokee and rummaged in his bag of tricks again. He brought out a Kodak disc camera and something that looked like a cross between a pistol and a blow dryer.
Your flare gun? Dugan asked, smiling a little.
Aye, yeah.
Get on the gas again, trooper. You're losing your color.
Dugan pulled it up, and the two men started toward that glittering thing in the woods. 50 feet from the Cherokee, Ev stopped. It was more than huge. It was titanic. A thing that would perhaps be large enough to dwarf an ocean liner when completely uncovered.
"Give me a hand," he said roughly to Dugan.
Dugan did as he asked, but wanted to know why.
"Because I'm scared shitless," Ev said.
Dugan squeezed his hand. Ev's arthritis flared, but he squeezed back anyway. After a moment, the two men started forward again. 17. Bobby and Judd got the guns from the hardware store and put them in the back of the pickup. The side trip hadn't taken long, but Dick and the others had gotten a good start, and Bobby pushed the pickup as fast as she dared to catch up. The truck's shadow, shortening as the day approached noon, ran beside them. Bobby suddenly stiffened a little behind the wheel.
"Did you hear it?"
"Heard something," Judd said. "It was your friend, wasn't it?"
Bobby nodded.
"Guards saw them. He's yelling for help."
"How many?"
"Two. In a jeep. They were headed out to where the ship is."
Judd brought a fist down on one leg.
"The fuckers! The dirty, snooping fuckers!"
"We'll catch them," Bobby said.
"Don't worry."
They were at the farm 15 minutes later. Bobby pulled her truck in behind Allison's Nova and Archenborg's Cadillac. She looked at the group of men and thought how much like the knights they had met out here this was. The ones who were to be made to become, first, especially strong. But Hazel wasn't here, and Beach was. Joe Summerfield and Adley McKean had never been inside the shed either. "Get the guns," she told Judd. "Joe, you help. Remember, no shooting unless you have to, and don't shoot the cop, no matter what."
She looked toward the porch and saw Guard lying there on his back. Guard's mouth was open and he was breathing in slow, rusty snores. Bobby's eyes softened.
There were plenty of people in Haven, Dick Allison and Newt Berenger probably chief among them, who thought she should long since have gotten rid of Guard. Nothing had been said out loud, but in Haven you no longer had to say things out loud. Bobby knew if she put a bullet through Guard's head, there would be a whole platoon of willing workers out here an hour later to help bury him. They didn't like Guard, because the plate in his head made him immune to the becoming, and it made him hard to read. But he was her break. And even that was crap. The truth was simpler yet. She still loved him. She was still human enough for that. And they would all have to admit that, drunk or not, when they had needed a warning, Guard had given it. Judd and Joe Summerfield came back with the rifles. There were 6 of them, varied calibers. Bobby saw that 5 went to people she could trust completely. She gave the 6th, a .22, to Beach, who would complain if he didn't get a shooting iron. Occupied with the ritual of guns, none of them saw that Gardner had half opened his bloodshot eyes and was looking at them. No one heard his thoughts. He had learned how to seal them off.
"Let's go," Bobby said, "and remember, I want that cop."
They moved out in a group. 18. Ev and Butch stood well back from the edge of what was now a ragged slash, running better than 300 yards from right to left, and yawning 60 feet across at its widest point. Anderson's old mongrel of a truck stood off to one side, looking tired and used. Next to it was the souped-up payloader with its giant screwdriver snout. There were other tools in the lean-to of peeled logs. Ev saw a chain fall on one side, a chipper on the other. There was a big pile of sodden sawdust below the mouth of the chipper's exhaust vent. There were cans of gasoline in the lean-to and a black drum labeled diesel. When Ev had first heard those noises in the woods, he had thought New England Paper must be doing some logging, but this was no logging operation.
This was an excavation. That dish, that monstrous dish, glittering in the sun. The eye could not stay away. It was drawn back again and again. Gardner and Bobby had removed a lot more hillside. 90 feet of polished silver-gray metal now jutted out of the earth and into the green-gold sunlight. If they had looked into the slash, they would have seen another 40 feet or better. Neither of them went close enough to look.
"Holy Jesus," Dugan said.
The gold cup bobbed on his face, and above its rim his blue eyes bulged.
"Holy Jesus, it's a spaceship. Is it ours, or is it Russian, do you think? Holy Jesus Christ, it's as big as the Queen Mary. That ain't Russian. That ain't.
He fell silent again. In spite of the oxygen, his headache was coming back. Ev raised the disc camera and clicked off 7 shots as fast as his finger could push the camera's button. Then he moved 20 feet to the left and took another 5, standing by the chipper.
"Move to the right," he said to Dugan.
"Huh?"
"You're right. I want you in these last 3, for perspective."
"Forget it, Pop." Even muffled by the cup, there was a shrill note in Dugan's voice.
"You don't have to. 4 steps will do it."
Dugan moved 4 very small steps to the right. Ev raised the disc camera again, a Father's Day present from Bryant and Marie, and clicked off the final 3 shots. Dugan was a very big man, but the ship in the earth reduced him to the size of a pygmy.
"Okay," Ev said. Dugan stepped quickly back to where he had been.
He walked with mincing, tentative steps, looking at the great round object as he went. Ev wondered if the pictures would turn out. His hands had been shaking, and the ship, for it certainly was some sort of spaceship, might be putting out radiation that would fog the film. Even if it does come out, who's going to believe it? Who, in a world where kids go off to the movies every damn Saturday and see things like Star Wars?
"I want to get out of here," Dugan said.
Ev looked at the ship a moment longer, wondering if David was in there, imprisoned, wandering through unknowable corridors, or passing through doorways cut for no human shape, starving in the darkness.
No. If he was in there, he would have starved a long time ago, starved or died of thirst.
Then he slipped the small camera in his pants pocket, walked back to Dugan, and picked up the flare gun.
"Yeah, I guess."
He broke off, looking in the direction of the Cherokee. There was a line of men and 1 woman standing in the trees, some armed. Ev recognized all of them. 19. Bobby started down the slope toward the 2 men. The others followed.
"Hello, Ev," Bobby said, pleasantly enough.
Dugan raised the .45, wishing bitterly for the familiar feel of his service .357.
"Stop," he said.
He didn't like the way the gold cup muffled the word, robbed it of authority. He pulled the air mask down.
"All of you! Those of you with rifles, put them down. You're all under arrest."
"You're outgunned, Butch," Newt Berenger said, pleasantly.
"Damn tooting,"
Beach growled. Dick Allison frowned at him.
"You better put your mask on again, Butch," Adley McKean said with a lazy, mocking smile. "I think you're losing it."
Butch had begun to feel woozy as soon as he pulled the mask off. Hearing the steady whisper of their thoughts made it worse. He pulled it up, wondering how much air could be left in the flat pack.
"Put it down," Bobby said. "And you put down the flare gun, Ev. No one wants to hurt you two."
"Where's David?" Ev asked roughly. "I want him, you bitch."
"He's on Altair 4, with Robbie the Robot and Dr. Mobius,"
Kyle Archenborg said with a titter.
"He's picnicking amid the Krell memory banks."
"Shut up," Bobby said. She suddenly felt confused, ashamed of herself, unsure.
Bitch? Was that what the old man had called her? A bitch?
She found herself wanting to tell him that he was confused. She wasn't a bitch.
That was her sister Anne. A sudden, confused image came to her. The old man's distress, Guard's distress, even her own, all mingled. She was distracted. While she was, Ev Hillman raised the flare pistol and fired. If Dugan had done it, they would have read his intention before he could have acted, but the old man was different. There was a hollow thud and a whoosh. Beach Jernigan exploded into white flame and staggered backward, the .22 flying out of his hands. His eyes filmed, simmered, then burst as they filled with burning phosphorus. His cheeks began to run. He opened his mouth and began to claw at his chest as the superheated air he drew in expanded and ruptured his lungs. This all happened in a space of seconds. The line of men wavered and lost coherency as they stumbled backward, their faces blank with terror. They were hearing Beach Jernigan die inside their heads. "Come on!" Ev shrieked at Dugan and ran for the Cherokee. Judd Tarkington moved sluggishly to stop him. Ev swept the hot barrel of the flare gun across his face, branding his cheek and breaking his nose. Judd went flailing backward, stumbling over his own feet, went sprawling. Beach was burning on the muddy, churned ground. He clawed weakly at his throat, with one twisted, tallowy hand, shuddered, and then stilled. Dugan got moving, running after the old man, who was clawing at the driver's side door of the Cherokee. Bobby heard Beach's thoughts fade away, wink out, and turned to see that the old man and the cop were on the verge of getting away. "Jesus Christ, you guys, stop them!" That broke their paralysis, but Bobby moved first. She got to Ev and slammed the butt of the shotgun she was carrying into the nape of the old man's neck. Ev's face whacked the top of the jeep's door. Blood sprayed from his nose and he dropped to his knees, dazed. Bobby raised the shotgun butt to hit him again when Dugan, standing on the other side of the Cherokee, fired the old man's .45 through the passenger window. Bobby felt a large, hot hammer suddenly slam her lower right shoulder. Her right arm was driven powerfully upward, and she lost her grip on the shotgun. The hammer numbed her flesh for a moment, and then the heat was back, an expanding furnace glow that was baking her from the inside out. She was thrown backward, her left hand going for the place the hammer had hit her, expecting to find blood, finding none, at least not yet, only a hole in her shirt and in the flesh beneath. The hole had hard edges that felt hot and throbby. Blood was running down her back, a lot of it, but shock had numbed her and she felt little pain yet. Her left hand had found the small entrance wound. The exit wound was as big as a kid's fist. She saw Dick Allison, his face white and slack with panic. "This isn't going right. Christ, not right at all. Get him before he gets us. Oh, you fucking snoop, fucking snoop, fucking snoop!" "Don't shoot him!" Bobby screamed. Pain exploded through her. Blood flew from her mouth in a scrawny spray. The bullet had torn her right lung open. Allison hesitated. Before Dugan could raise the gun again, Newt and Joe Summerfield had stepped in. Dugan turned toward them, and Newt clubbed the barrel of his rifle down on the hand holding the .45 as he did. Dugan's second shot went into the dirt.
"Hold it, trooper! Hold it or you're dead!"
John Enders, the grammar school principal, screamed.
"Four guns on you right now!"
Dugan looked around. He saw four men with rifles. And Allison, still wall-eyed and only one small step from unglued, looked ready to shoot the moment a squirrel farted. "They'll kill you anyway. Might as well go out like John Wayne. Shit, they're all crazy."
"No!"
Bobby said. She was leaning against the jeep's hood now. Blood trickled steadily from her mouth. The back of her shirt was soaking.
"We're not crazy. We're not going to kill you. Check me."
Dugan probed clumsily toward Bobby Anderson's mind and saw that she meant it. But there was a catch somewhere, something he might have caught on to if he hadn't been so new at this eerie mind-reading trick. It was like the fine print in some slick car salesman's contract. He would think about it later. These guys were amateurs, and there might still be a chance to get away clean, if... Suddenly, Adley McKean ripped the gold mask off his face. Butch felt a wave of dizziness almost at once.
"I like you better this way," Adley said.
You won't think so much about escaping with your goddamn canned air turned off.
Butch fought the dizziness and looked back at Bobby Anderson. I think she's going to die.
Think what you want.
He straightened and took a step backward as that unexpected thought filled his head. He looked at her more closely.
What about the old man? He asked flatly.
Not... Bobby coughed, spraying more blood. Bubbles formed on her nostrils. Kyle and Newt started toward her. Bobby waved them back.
Not your business. You and me are going to get in the front of the jeep.
You drive. There'll be three men with guns in the back, if you think of trying anything funny.
I want to know what's going to happen to the old man, Butch repeated.
Bobby raised her gun with great effort. She brushed her sweaty hair away from her eyes with her left hand. Her right dangled uselessly by her side. It was as if she wanted Dugan to see her very clearly, to measure her. Butch did. The coldness he saw in her eyes was real.
I don't want to kill you, she said softly. You know that. But if you say one more word, I'll have these men execute you right here. We'll bury you next to beach and take our chances.
Ev Hillman was struggling to his feet. He looked dazed, not sure where he was. He armed blood off his forehead like sweat. Another wave of dizziness washed through Butch, and a thought of infinite comfort came to him.
This is a dream. All just a dream.
Bobby smiled without humor.
Think that if you want, she said. Just get in the jeep.
Butch got in and slid across behind the wheel. Bobby started around to the passenger side. She began coughing again, spraying blood, and her knees buckled. Two of the others had to help her.
Never mind the think. I know she's going to die.
Bobby turned her head and looked at him. That clear, mental voice,
"Think what you want," filled his head again.
Archenborg, Summerfield, and McKean crammed into the back seat of the Cherokee.
Drive.
Bobby whispered.
Slow.
Butch began to back up. He would see Everett Hillman once more, but would not remember. Later, most of Butch's mind would have been rubbed away like chalk from a blackboard. The old man stood there in the sunlight, that stupendous saucer shape behind him. He was surrounded by big men, and 5 feet to his left there was something on the ground that looked like a charred log.
You didn't do too bad, old man. In your day you must have been quite a high rider. And you sure as hell weren't crazy.
Hillman looked up and shrugged, as if to say,
Well, we tried.
More dizziness. Butch's sight wavered.
I'm not sure I can drive, he said, his voice seeming to boom into his ears from a great distance. That thing, it makes me sick. Is there any air left in his little kit, Adley?
Bobby whispered. Her face was ashy pale. The blood on her lips seemed very red by comparison.
Face mask's hissing a little. Put it on him.
A moment after it was jammed firmly over Butch's mouth and nose again, he began to improve.
Enjoy it while you can,
Bobby whispered, and then passed out. 20.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, thus we commit the body of our friend Ruth McCausland to the ground, and her soul to a loving God.
The mourners had moved on to the pretty little graveyard on the hill west of the village. They stood loosely gathered around an open grave. Ruth's casket was suspended over it on runners. There were far fewer mourners here than there had been in the church. Many of the out-of-towners, either headachy and nauseated or glowing feverishly with strange new ideas, had taken the chance afforded by the intermission between acts to slip away. The flowers at the head of the grave ruffled gently in a fresh summer breeze. As the Reverend Goo-Ringer raised his head, he saw a bright yellow rose go twirling down the grassy hill. Beyond and below Homeland's weather-beaten white fence, he could see the town hall clock tower. It wavered slightly in the bright air, like something seen through a heat haze. Still, Gooringer thought it was a damned good illusion. These strangers in town had seen the best magic lantern slide in history, and didn't even know it. His eyes met Frank Spruce's for just an instant. He read relief clearly in Frank's eyes, and he supposed Frank could see it just as clearly in his own. Many of the outsiders would go back to wherever they came from and tell their friends that Ruth's death had rocked the little community to its foundations. They had hardly seemed to be there at all. What none of them knew, Gooringer reflected, was that they had been following the events near the ship with most of their attention. For a while, things out there had gone very badly. Now they were under control again. But Bobby Anderson might die if they couldn't get her back to the shed in time, and that was bad. Still, things were under control. The becoming would continue. That was the only important consideration. Gooringer held his Bible open in one hand. Its pages fluttered a little in the wind. Now he raised the other hand in the air. The mourners standing around Ruth's grave lowered their heads.
May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord lift up his face and make it shine upon you and give you peace. Amen.
The mourners raised their heads. Gooringer smiled.
There'll be refreshments in the library for those of you who'd care to stop by for a while and remember Ruth, he said.
Act Two was over. 21. Kyle reached gently into Bobby's pants pocket and probed until he found her key ring. He worked it out, picked through the keys, and found the one that opened the padlock on the shed door. He inserted the key in the lock, but didn't turn it. Adley and Joe Summerfield were covering Dugan, who was still behind the wheel of the jeep. Butch was finding it harder and harder to pull air from the mask. The needle on the supply dial had been in the red for 5 minutes now. Kyle rejoined them.
"Go check the drunk," Kyle said to Joe Summerfield. "Looks like he's still passed out, but I don't trust the fucker."
Joe crossed the side yard, climbed the porch, and examined Gardner carefully, wincing at his sour breath. This time there really was no sham. Gardner had gotten a fresh bottle of scotch and had drunk himself into oblivion. As the two other men stood waiting for Joe to come back, Kyle said, "Bobby is most likely going to die. If she does, I'm going to get rid of that lush first thing." Joe came back.
"He's out."
Kyle nodded and turned the key in the shed's padlock as Joe joined Adley in keeping the cop covered. Kyle pulled the lock free and opened the door part way. Brilliant green light poured out. It was so bright it seemed to dim the sunlight. There was an odd liquid churning sound. It was almost, but not quite, the sound of machinery. Kyle took an involuntary step backward, his face tightening momentarily into an expression of fright, revulsion, and awe. The smell alone, thick and fetid and organic, was damn near enough to knock a man over. Kyle understood, they all did, that the two-hearted nature of the Tommyknockers was now growing together. The dance of deception was nearly done. Liquid churning sounds, that smell, and then another sound, something like the feeble, bubbly yap of a drowning dog. Kyle had been in the shed twice before, but remembered little about it. He knew, of course, that it was an important place, a fine place, and that it had speeded his own becoming. But the human part of him was still almost superstitiously afraid of it. He came back to Adley and Joe.
"We can't wait for the others. We've got to get Bobby in there right now, if there's going to be any chance of saving her at all."
The cop, he saw, had taken off the mask. It lay, used up, on the seat beside him. That was good. As Adley said out in the woods, he would think less about escaping without his canned air.
"Keep your gun on the cop," Kyle said. "Joe, help me with Bobby."
"Help you take her into the shed?"
"No. Help me take her to the Rumford Zoo so she can see the fucking lion," Kyle shouted. "Of course, the shed."
I don't think I want to go in there. Not just now."
Joe looked from that green light back to Kyle, a shamed, slightly sickened smile on his lips.
"I'll help you," Adley said softly. "Bobby's a good old sport. Be a shame if she croaked before we got to the end of it."
"All right," Kyle said. "Cover the cop," he said to Joe. "And if you screw up, I swear to God, I'll kill you."
"I won't, Kyle," Joe said.
That shamed grin still hung on his mouth, but there was no mistaking the relief in his eyes.
"I sure won't. I'll watch him good."
"See that you do," Bobby said feebly.
It startled them all. Kyle looked at her, then back at Joe. Joe flinched away from the naked contempt in Kyle's eyes. But he didn't look toward the shed, toward that light, those churning, squelching sounds. "Come on, Adley," Kyle said at last. "Let's get Bobby in there. Soonest started, soonest done." Adley McKean, 50-ish, balding and stocky, flagged for only a moment. "Is it—" he licked his lips. "Kyle, is it bad? In there?" "I don't really remember," Kyle said. "All I know is I felt wonderful when I came out. Like I knew more, could do more."
"Oh,"
Adley said in an almost non-existent voice.
"You'll be one of us, Adley,"
Bobby said in that same feeble voice. Adley's face, although still frightened, firmed up again.
"All right,"
he said. "Let's try not to hurt her," Kyle said. They got Bobby into the shed. Joe Summerfield turned his attention briefly away from Dugan to watch them disappear into that glow, and it seemed to him that they really did disappear rather than just step inside. It was like watching objects disappear into a dazzling corona. His lapse was brief, but it was all the old Butch Dugan would have needed. Even now he saw the opportunity, but he was simply unable to use it. No strength in his legs, churning nausea in his stomach. His head thudded and pounded.
"I don't want to go in there."
Nothing he could do about it if they decided to drag him in, though. He was as weak as a kitten. He drifted. After a while he heard voices and raised his head. It took an effort, because it seemed as if someone had poured cement into one of his ears until his head was full of it. The rest of the posse was pushing out of the tangle that was Bobby Anderson's garden. They were shoving the old man roughly along. Hillman's feet tangled and he fell down. One of them, Tarkington, kicked him to his feet, and Butch got the run of Tarkington's thoughts clearly. He was outraged at what he thought of as the murder of Beach Jernigan. Hillman stumbled on toward the Cherokee. The shed door opened then. Kyle Archenborg and Adley McKean came out. McKean no longer looked frightened. His eyes were glowing, and a big, toothless grin stretched his lips. But that wasn't all. Something else. Then Butch realized. In the few minutes the two men had been inside there, a large portion of Adley McKean's hair appeared to have disappeared.
"I'll go in any time, Kyle," he was saying. "No problem."
There was more, but now everything wanted to drift away again. Butch let it. The world dimmed out until there was nothing left but those churning sounds and the afterimage of green light on his eyelids. 22. Act 3. They sat in the town library. The name would be changed to the Ruth McCausland Memorial Library, all agreed. They drank coffee, iced tea, Coca-Cola, ginger ale. They drank nothing that was alcoholic. Not at Ruth's wake. They ate tiny triangular tuna fish sandwiches. They ate similar ones containing a paste of cream cheese and olives. They ate sandwiches containing a paste of cream cheese and pimento. They ate cold cuts and a jello salad with shreds of carrot suspended in it like fossils in amber. They talked a great deal, but the room was mostly silent. If it had been bugged, the listeners would have been disappointed. The tension that had drawn many faces tight in the church as the situation in the woods teetered on the dangerous verge of careening out of control, had now smoothed out. Bobby was in the shed. That nosy Parker of an old man had also been taken in. Last of all, the nosy Parker policeman had been taken into the shed. The group mind lost track of these people as they went into the thick, corroded brass glow of that green light. They ate and drank and listened and talked, and no one said a word, and that was all right. The last of the outsiders had left town following Gueringer's graveside benediction, and they had haven to themselves again.
"Will it be all right now?"
"Yes, they'll understand about Dugan. Are you sure?" "Yes, they will understand. They will think they understand." The tick of the Seth Thomas on the mantelpiece, donated by the grammar school after last year's spring bottle and can drive, was the loudest sound in the room. Occasionally there was the decorous clink of a china cup. Faintly beyond the open-screened windows, the sound of a faraway airplane. No birdsong. It was not missed. They ate and drank, and when Dugan was escorted from Bobby's shed around 1:30 that afternoon, they knew. People rose, and now talk, real talk, began all at once. Tupperware bowls were capped, uneaten sandwiches were popped into baggies. Claudette Ruval, Ashley's mother, put a piece of aluminum foil over the remains of the casserole she had brought. They all went outside and headed toward their homes, smiling and chatting. Act 3 was over. 23. Gardner came to around sundown with a hangover headache and a feeling that things had happened which he could not quite remember. "Finally made it, Gard," he thought. "Finally had yourself another blackout." "Satisfied?" He managed to get off the porch and to walk shakily around the corner of the house, out of view of the road, before throwing up. He saw blood in the vomit and wasn't surprised. This wasn't the first time, although there was more blood this time than ever before. Dreams. Christ, he'd had some weird nightmares, blackout or no. People out here, coming and going. So many people. But all they needed was a brass band and the Dallas police. The Dallas police were out here this morning, and you got drunk so you wouldn't see them, you fucking coward. Cowgirls. Nightmares, that was all. He turned away from the puddle of puke between his feet. The world was wavering in and out of focus with every beat of his heart, and Gardner suddenly knew that he had edged very close to death. He was committing suicide after all, just doing it slowly. He put his arm against the side of the house and his forehead on his arm.
"Mr. Gardner, are you all right?"
"Huh?" he cried, jerking upright. His heart slammed two violent beats, stopped for what seemed forever, and then began to beat so rapidly he could barely distinguish the individual pulses. His headache suddenly cranked up to overload. He whirled. Bobby Tremaine stood there, looking surprised, even a little amused, but not really sorry for the scare he had given Gardner.
"Gee, I didn't mean to creep up on you, Mr. Gardner."
"You fucking well did, and I fucking well know it." The Tremaine kid blinked rapidly several times. He had caught some of that, Gardner saw. He found he didn't give a shit. "Where's Bobby?" he asked. I know who you are. I know where you are, right in front of me. Where's Bobby?"
"Well, I'll tell you,"
Bobby Tremaine said. His face became very open, very wide-eyed, very honest, and Gardner was suddenly forcibly reminded of his teaching days. This was how students who had spent a long winter weekend skiing, screwing, and drinking looked when they started to explain that they couldn't turn in their research papers today because their mothers had died on Saturday.
"Sure. Tell me."
Gardner leaned against the clabbered side of the house, looking at the teenager in the reddish glow of sunset. Over his shoulder he could see the shed, padlocked, its windows boarded up. The shed had been in the dream, he remembered.
"Dream?
or whatever it is you don't want to admit was real. For a moment the kid looked genuinely disconcerted by Gardner's cynical expression.
Miss Anderson had sunstroke. Some of the men found her near the ship and took her to Derry Home Hospital. You were passed out.
Gardner straightened up quickly. Is she all right?
I don't know. They're still with her. No one has called here.
Not since 3 o'clock or so, anyway. That's when I got out here. Gardner pushed away from the building and started around the house, head down, working against the hangover. He had believed the kid was going to lie, and perhaps he had lied about the nature of what had happened to Bobby, but Gardner sensed a core of truth in what the kid said. Bobby was sick, hurt, something. It explained those dreamlike comings and goings he remembered. He supposed Bobby had called them with her mind. Sure. Called them with her mind. Neatest trick of the week. Only in Haven, ladies and germs.
Where are you going?
Tremaine asked, his voice suddenly very sharp. Derry. Gardner had reached the head of the driveway. Bobby's pickup was parked there. The Tremaine kid's big yellow Dodge Challenger was pulled in next to it. Gardner turned back toward the kid. The sunset had painted harsh red highlights and black shadows on the boy's face, making him look like an Indian. Gardner took a closer look and realized he wasn't going anywhere. This kid with the fast car and the football hero shoulders hadn't been put out here just to give Guard the bad news as soon as Guard managed to throw off enough of the booze to rejoin the living.
Am I supposed to believe Bobby was out there in the woods, excavating away like a madwoman, and she keeled over with a sunstroke while her sometime partner was lying back on the porch drunk as a coot? That it? Well, that's a good trick, because she was supposed to be at the McCausland woman's funeral. She went into the village, and I was out here alone, and I started thinking about what I saw Sunday. I started thinking, and then I started drinking, which is mostly the way it works with me. Of course, Bobby could have gone to the funeral, come back here, changed, gone out in the woods to work, and then had a sunstroke. Except that isn't what happened. The kid's lying. It's written all over his face. And all of a sudden, I'm very fucking glad he can't read my thoughts.
I think Miss Anderson would rather have you stay here and keep on with the work, Bobby Tremaine said evenly.
You think?
That is, we all think.
The kid looked momentarily more disconcerted than ever, wary, a bit rocky on his feet.
Didn't expect Bobby's pet drunk to have any teeth or claws left, I guess.
That kicked off another much queerer thought, and he looked at the kid more closely in the light, which was now fading into orange and ashy pink. Football hero's shoulders, a handsome, cleft-chinned face that might have been drawn by Alex Gordon or Bernie Wrightson, deep chest, narrow waist. Bobby Tremaine, All-American. No wonder the Coulson girl was nuts over him. But that sunken, infirm-looking mouth went oddly with the rest, Gardner thought. They were the ones who kept losing teeth, not Gardner.
Okay, what's he here for? To guard me, to make sure I stay put, no matter what.
Well, all right, he said to Tremaine in a softer, more conciliatory voice, if that's what you all think. Tremaine relaxed a little.
It really is.
Well, let's go in and put on the coffee. I could use some. My head aches. And we'll have to get going early in the morning.
He stopped and looked at Tremaine. You are going to help out, aren't you? That's part of it, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Gardner nodded. He looked at the shed for a moment, and in the fading light he could see brilliant green tattooed in the small spaces between the boards. For a moment his dream shimmered, almost within his grasp. Deadly shoemakers hammering away at unknown devices in that green glare. He had never seen the glow as bright as this before. And he noticed that when Tremaine glanced in that direction, his eyes skittered away uneasily. The lyric of an old song floated, not quite randomly, into Gardner's mind and then out again. "Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Green door, what's that secret you're keeping?" And there was a sound, faint, rhythmic, not at all identifiable, but somehow unpleasant. The two of them had faltered. Now Gardner moved on toward the house. Tremaine followed him gratefully. "Good," Gardner said, as if the conversation had never lagged. "I can use some help. Bobby figured we'd get down to some sort of hatchway in about 2 weeks, that we'd be able to get inside." "Yes, I know," Tremaine said without hesitation. "But that was with two of us working."
"Oh, there'll always be someone else with you,"
Tremaine said, and smiled openly. A chill rippled up Gardner's back.
"Oh?
Yes, you bet. Until Bobby comes back."
"Until then,"
Tremaine agreed. "Except he doesn't think Bobby's going to be back, ever." "Come on," he said. "Coffee, then maybe some chow."
"Sounds good to me."
They went inside, leaving the shed to churn and mutter to itself in the growing dark. As the sun disappeared, the stitching of green at the cracks grew brighter and brighter and brighter. A cricket hopped into the luminous pencil mark one of these cracks printed onto the ground and fell dead. Chapter 10 A Book of Days. The Town Concluded. 1. Thursday, July 28th. Butch Dugan woke up in his own bed in Derry at exactly 3:05 a.m. He pushed back the covers and swung his feet out onto the floor. His eyes were wide and dazed, his face puffy with sleep. The clothes he had worn on his trip to Haven with the old man the day before were on the chair by his small desk. There was a pen in the breast pocket of the shirt. He wanted that pen. This seemed to be the only thought his mind would clearly admit. He got up, went to the chair, took the pen, tossed the shirt on the floor, sat down, and then just sat for several moments, looking out into the darkness, waiting for the next thought. Butch had gone into Anderson's shed, but very little of him had come out. He seemed shrunken, lessened. He had no clear memories of anything. He could not have told a questioner his own middle name. And he did not at all remember being driven to the Haven Troy town line in the Cherokee Hillman had rented, or sliding behind the wheel after Adley McKean got out and walked back to Kyle Archenborg's Cadillac. He likewise did not remember driving back to Derry. Yet all these things had happened. He had parked the Cherokee in front of the old man's apartment building, locked it, then got into his own car. 2 blocks away, he had stopped long enough to drop the Jeep keys into a sewer. He went directly to bed, and had slept until the alarm clock planted in his mind woke him up. Now some new switch clicked over. Butch blinked once or twice, opened a drawer, and drew out a pad of paper. He wrote, "I told people Tuesday night I couldn't go to her funeral because I was sick. That was true, but it was not my stomach. I was going to ask her to marry me, but kept putting it off, afraid she'd say no. If I hadn't been scared, she might be alive now. With her dead, there doesn't seem to be anything to look forward to. I am sorry about this mess." He looked the note over for a moment and then signed his name at the bottom, Anthony F. Dugan. He laid the pen and note aside, and went back to sitting bolt upright and looking out the window. At last another relay kicked over. The last relay. He got up and went to the closet. He ran the combination of the wall safe at the back and removed his .357 mag. He put the belt over his shoulder, went back to the desk and sat down. He thought for a moment, frowning, then got up, turned off the light in the closet, shut the closet door, went back to the desk, sat down again, took the .357 from its holster, put the muzzle of the gun firmly against his left eyelid, and pulled the trigger. The chair toppled and hit the floor with a flat, undramatic wooden clap. The sound of a gallows trap door springing open. 2. Front page, Bangor Daily News, Friday, July 29th. Derry State Policeman Apparent Suicide. Was in charge of trooper disappearance investigation. By John Leandro. Captain Anthony Butch Dugan of the Derry State Police Barracks apparently shot himself with his service revolver early Thursday morning. His death hit the Derry Barracks, which was rocked last week by the disappearance of two troopers, hard indeed. 3. Saturday, July 30th. Gardner sat on a stump in the woods, his shirt off, eating a tuna and egg sandwich and drinking iced coffee laced with brandy. Across from him, sitting on another stump, was John Enders, the school principal. Enders was not built for hard work, and although it was only noon, he looked hot and tired and almost fagged out. Gardner nodded toward him. "Not bad," he said. "Better than Tremaine, anyway. Tremaine had burned water trying to boil it." Enders smiled wanly. "Thank you." Gardner looked beyond him to the great circular shape jutting from the ground. The ditch kept widening, and they had to keep using more and more of that silvery netting which somehow kept it from caving in. He had no idea how they made it, only knew that the large supply in the cellar had been almost depleted, and then, yesterday, a couple of women from town had come out in a van with a fresh supply, neatly folded like freshly ironed curtains. They needed more because they kept taking away more and more of the hillside. And still the thing continued down. Bobby's whole house could now have fit into its shadow. He looked at Enders again. Enders was looking at it with an expression of adoring, religious awe, as if he were a rube druid, and this was his first trip from the boonies to see Stonehenge. Gardner got up, staggering slightly. "Come on," he said. "Let's do a little blasting." He and Bobby had reached a point weeks earlier where the ship was as tightly embedded in dour bedrock as a piece of steel and concrete. The bedrock hadn't hurt the ship, hadn't put so much as a scratch on its pearl-gray hull, let alone dented or crushed it. But it was tightly plugged. The plug had to be blasted away. It would have been a job for a construction crew who understood how to use dynamite, a lot of dynamite, under other circumstances. But there was explosive available in Haven these days that made dynamite obsolete. Gardner still wasn't clear on what the explosion in Haven Village had been, and wasn't sure he ever wanted to be clear on it. It was a moot point, anyway, because no one was talking. Whatever it had been, he was sure that some huge piece of brickwork had taken off like a rocket, and some of those new and improved explosives had been involved. There had been a time, he remembered, when he had actually wasted time speculating on whether or not the super brain food Bobby's artifact was putting into the air could produce weapons. That time now seemed incredibly distant, that Jim Gardner, incredibly naive. "Can you make it, Johnny?" he asked the school principal. Enders got up, wincing, putting his hands in the small of his back. He looked desperately tired, but he managed a small smile just the same. Looking at the ship seemed to refresh him. Blood was trickling from the corner of one eye, however, a single red tear. Something in there had ruptured. "It's being this close to the ship," Gard thought. On the first of the 2 days Bobby Tremaine had spent helping him, he had spit out his last few teeth like machine gun bullets almost as soon as they got here. He thought of telling Enders that something behind his right eye was leaking, then decided to let him discover it on his own. The guy would be all right. Probably. Even if he wasn't, Gardner wasn't sure he cared. This, more than anything else, shocked him. Why should it? Are you kidding yourself that these cats are human anymore? If you are, you better wise up, guard, old guard. He headed down the slope, stopping at the last stump before rocky soil gave way to chipped and runneled bedrock. He picked up a cheap transistor radio made of yellow, high-impact plastic. It looked like Snoopy. Attached to it was the board from a Sharp calculator. And, of course, batteries. Humming, Gardner made his way down to the edge of the trench. There the music dried up and he was quiet, only staring at the titanic gray flank of the ship. The view did not refresh him, but it did inspire a deep awe, which had overtones of steadily darkening fear.
But you still hope, too. You'd be a liar if you said you didn't. The key could still be here. Somewhere.
As the fear darkened, however, the hope did, too. Soon, he thought it would be gone. The hillside excavation now made the ship's flank too far away to touch. Not that he wanted to. He didn't enjoy the sensation of having his head turning into a very large speaker. It hurt. He rarely bled now when he did touch it, and touching it was sometimes inevitable. But the blast of radio always came, and on occasion his nose or ears could still spray a hell of a lot more blood than he cared to look at. Gardner wondered briefly just how much borrowed time he was now living on. But that question was also moot. From the morning he had awakened on that New Hampshire breakwater, it had all been borrowed time. He was a sick man, and he knew it, but not too sick to appreciate the irony of the situation in which he found himself. After busting his hump to dig this fucker up with a variety of tools, which looked as if they might have come out of the Hugo Gernsback Whole Universe catalog, after doing what the rest of them probably couldn't have done without working themselves to death in a kind of hypnotic trance, he might not be able to go inside when and if they came to the hatch Bobby believed was there. But he meant to try. You could bet your watch and chain on that. Now he set his boot into a rope stirrup, slid the knot tight, and put the Snoopy radio in his shirt. "Let me down easy, Johnny." Anders began to turn a windlass, and Gardner began to slide downward. Beside him, the smooth gray hull slid up and up and up. If they wanted to get rid of him, this would be as easy a way as any, he supposed. Just send a telepathic order to Enders. Let go of the wheel, John. We're through with him. And down he would plunge 40 feet to the solid bedrock at the bottom, slack rope trailing up behind him. Crunch! But, of course, he was at their mercy anyhow. And he supposed they recognized his usefulness, however reluctantly. The Tremaine kid was young, strong as a bull, but he had fagged out in 2 days. Enders was going to last out today, maybe. But Gardner would have bet his watch and chain. What watch and chain? Ha ha. That there would be somebody else out here tomorrow to keep tabs on him. Bobby was okay. Bullshit, she was. If you hadn't come back, she would have killed herself. But she hung in there better than Enders or the Tremaine kid. His mind returned inexorably. Bobby went into the shed with the others. Tremaine and Enders never did. At least, not that you ever saw. Maybe that's the difference. So what's in there? 10,000 angels dancing on the head of a pin? The ghost of James Dean? The Shroud of Turin? What? He didn't know. His foot touched down at the bottom. "I'm down," he yelled. Ender's face, looking very small, appeared at the edge of the cut. Beyond, Gardner could see a tiny wedge of blue sky. Too tiny. Claustrophobia whispered in his ear, a voice as rough as sandpaper. The space between the side of the ship and the wall covered with that silvery netting was very narrow down here. Gardner had to move with great care to avoid touching the ship's side and setting off one of those brain bursts. The bedrock was very dark. He squatted and ran his fingers over it. They came away wet. They had come away a little wetter each day for the last week. That morning he had cut a small square 4 inches on a side and a foot into the floor of the bedrock using a gadget that had once been a blow-dryer. Now he opened his toolkit, removed a flashlight, and shone the light into it. Water down there. He got to his feet and screamed, "Send down the hose!"
"What?"
drifted down. Enders sounded apologetic. Gardner sighed, wondering just how much longer he himself could hold out against the steady drag of exhaustion. All this Hugo Gernsback whole universe equipment, and no one thought to rig an intercom between up there and down here. Instead, they were screaming their throats out.
Oh, but none of their bright ideas run in that direction, and you know it. Why would they think about intercoms when they can read thoughts? You're the horse and buggy human here, not them.
"The hose!" he shrieked. "Send down the motherfucking hose, tripehead!"
"Okay."
Gardner stood waiting for the hose to come down, wishing miserably that he was anywhere else in the world than here, wishing he could convince himself all of it was only a nightmare. It was no good. The ship was madly exotic, but this reality was also too prosy to be a dream. The acrid smell of John Ender's sweat, the slightly boozy smell of his own, the dig of the rope loop into his instep as he went down into the cut, the feel of rough, moist bedrock under his fingers.
"Where's Bobby, guard? Is she dead?"
No, he didn't think she was dead, but he had become convinced that she was desperately ill. Something had happened to her on Wednesday. Something had happened to all of them on Wednesday. Gardner could not quite bring his memories into focus, but he knew there had been no real blackout or DT nightmare. It would have been better for him if there had been. There had been some sort of cover-up last Wednesday, a frantic cut and paste, and in the course of it he believed that Bobby had been hurt, taken ill, something. But they're not talking about it. Bobby Tremaine.
"Bobby? Heck, Mr. Gardner. Nothing wrong with Bobby. Just a little old heat stroke. She'll be back in no time. She can use the rest. You know that better than anyone, I guess."
It sounded great. So great you'd almost think the Tremaine kid believed it himself until you looked closely at his odd eyes. He could see himself going to those he was coming to think of as the shed people, demanding to know what had happened to her. Newt Barringer. Next thing you know, he'll be trying to tell us that we're the Dallas police. And boy, they'd sure all start to laugh then, wouldn't they? Them, the Dallas police? That was pretty funny. That was a scream. Maybe, Gard thought, that's why I feel so much like doing it. Screaming, I mean. Now he stood deep in this man-made crack in the earth. A crack that contained a titanic, alien, flying ship, waiting for the hose to come down. And suddenly the final horrible passage of George Orwell's Animal Farm clanged in his head like a death cry. It was strange, the things you discovered you'd gotten by heart. Clover's old eyes flitted from one face to another, and as the animals outside looked from pig to man, and man to pig, and pig to man again, it seemed that some strange thing was happening. It was impossible to say which was which.
"Jesus, guard, cut it out!"
Here came the hose at last, a 70-footer from the volunteer fire department. It was, of course, meant to spray water, not suck it up, but a vacuum pump had neatly reversed its function. Enders paid it out jerkily. The end swung back and forth, sometimes striking the hull of the ship. Each time this happened, there was a cludding sound that was dull yet curiously penetrating. Gardner didn't like it, and quickly came to anticipate each clud.
Christ, I wish he hadn't got that thing swinging.
Clud. Clud. Clud.
Why can't it just clink?
Why does it have to keep making that other sound, like dirt being shoveled on top of a coffin? Clud. Clud. Clud.
Christ, I should have jumped when I had the chance. Just stepped off that fucking breakwater at Arcadia Beach.
July 4th, wasn't it? Shit, I could have been a Yankee Doodle debtor. Well, go on then. When you go back to the house tonight, gobble all the Valium in the medicine cabinet. Kill yourself if you haven't got the guts to either see this thing through or put a stop to it. The good people of Haven will probably throw a party over your body.
You think they want you here? If there wasn't some of the old, unimproved Bobby still around, I think you'd be gone already. If she wasn't standing between you and them, clud, clud, clud.
Was Bobby still standing between him and the rest of Haven?
Yeah. But if she died, how long would it be before he himself was scrubbed from the equation? Not long, buddy. Not long at all. Like maybe 15 minutes? Clud. 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 Wincing, teeth set against the dull, dead sound, Guard leapt up and caught the brass nozzle of the hose before it could rap against the side of the ship again. He pulled it down, knelt over the hole, and craned his head up at Ender's small face.
"Start the pump!" he yelled.
"What?" Jesus wept, Gardner thought.
"Start the motherfucking pump!" he shrieked.
And this time he felt, actually felt, his head fall apart. He closed his eyes.
"Okay."
When he looked up, Anders was gone. Gardner plunged the end of the hose into the glory hole he had cut out from rock that morning. The water began to bubble slowly, almost contemplatively. It was frigid at first, but his hands quickly became numb. Although the trench he was in was only 40 feet deep, they had removed a whole hillside in the process of cutting a base level, so that the place where Gardner now crouched had probably been, until late June, 90 feet under the earth. Measuring the freeboard surface of the ship would have given an exact figure, but Gardner didn't give a shit. The simple fact was that they seemed to have nearly reached the aquifer, spongy rock filled with water. Apparently the bottom half or two-thirds of the ship was floating in a large underground lake. His hands were now so numb they had forgotten what they were.
"Come on, asshole," he muttered.
As if in answer, the hose began to vibrate and wriggle. He couldn't hear the pump's motor from here, but he didn't have to. As the water level in the glory hole dropped, Gardner was able to see his reddened, dripping hands again. He watched as the water level continued to drop.
"If we hit the aquifer, it's going to slow us down."
"Yeah, we might lose a whole day while they figure out some sort of super pump. There might be a delay, but nothing's going to stop them, Guard. Don't you know that?" The hose began to emit the sound of a giant soda straw in a giant Coke glass. The glory hole was empty.
"Turn it off!" he shouted.
Enders just went on looking down at him. Gardner sighed and yanked hard on the hose. Enders looked startled, then made a thumb and forefinger circle at Gardner. He disappeared. A few seconds later, the hose stopped vibrating. Then it began to rise as Enders wound it up. Gardner made sure that the end of it was perfectly still and wouldn't pendulum before he let it go. He now took the radio out of his shirt and turned it on. There was a built-in 10-minute delay. He put the radio on the bottom of the glory hole, then covered it with loose chunks of rock. A lot of the explosion's force would be channeled upward anyway, but this was powerful stuff, whatever it was. Enough would be left to tear perhaps 3 vertical feet of bedrock into chunks, which they could quickly load into a sling and power winch up. And the ship would not be hurt. Apparently, nothing could do that. Gardner slid his foot into the sling and shouted,
"Pull me up!"
Nothing happened.
"Pull me up, Johnny!"
he screamed. Once again there was that feeling that his head was splitting along some rotted mid-seam. Still nothing. His wrist-deep plunge into the icy water had dropped Gardner's body temperature perhaps 2 whole degrees. Nonetheless, a damp and slickly unpleasant sweat suddenly sprang out on his forehead. He looked at his wristwatch. 2 minutes had passed since he had turned on the Snoopy radio. From his watch, his eyes moved to the loose pile of chunked granite in the glory hole. Plenty of time to yank the rocks out and turn off the radio. Except turning off the radio wouldn't stop whatever was going on inside the radio. He knew that somehow.
He looked up for Enders, and Enders wasn't there. This is how they're getting rid of you, guard. A drop of sweat ran into his eyes. He brushed it away with the back of his hand. Enders! Hey! Johnny!
Shinny up the rope, guard.
40 feet?
Dream on. Maybe in college. Maybe not even then.
He looked at his watch.
3 minutes.
Yeah, this is how. Poof, all gone. A sacrifice to the great ship. A little something to propitiate the Tommyknockers.
Start it going yet?
He looked up so quickly his neck popped, his growing fear turning immediately to rage.
I started it almost 5 minutes ago, you fucking shit for brains. Get me out of here before it goes off and blows me sky high.
Ender's mouth dropped into an O that was almost comical. He disappeared again, and Gardner was left looking at his watch through what was becoming a blur of sweat. Then the loop around his foot jerked, and a moment later he began to rise. Gardner closed his eyes and clung to the rope. Apparently he wasn't quite as ready to sniff the pipe as he thought he was. Maybe that wasn't such a bad thing to know, either. He reached the top of the cut, stepped out, loosened the loop around his foot, and walked over to where Enders stood.
Sorry, Enders said, smiling fussily. I thought we'd agreed that you'd give me a shout before
Gardner hit him. The thing was done, and Enders was on the ground, his glasses hanging from one ear and his mouth bloody, before Gardner was even wholly aware of what he meant to do. And although he was not telepathic, he thought he could feel every head in Haven suddenly turn toward this place, alert and listening.
"You left me down there with that thing going, asshole," he said. "If you or anyone else in this town ever does it again, you better just leave me down there. Do you hear me?"
Rage dawned in Ender's eyes. He fixed his glasses back in place as well as he could and got to his feet. There was dirt on his bald head.
"I don't think you know who you're talking to." "I know more than you think," Gardner said. "Listen, Johnny, and the rest of you, if you're hearing this, and I think you are, you listen too. I want an intercom down there. I want some ordinary fucking consideration. I've played square with you. I'm the only one in this town that didn't have to have his brain scrambled to do it, either. I want some fucking consideration. Do you hear me?"
Enders looked at him, but Gardner thought he was listening, too. Listening to other voices. Gardner waited for their decision. He was too angry to really care much.
"All right," Enders said softly, pressing the back of his hand against his bloody mouth. "You may have a point. We'll put in an intercom, and we'll see that you have a bit more... what did you call it?" A contemptuous flick of smile touched his lips. It was a smile with which Gardner was extremely familiar. It was the way the Arbergs and McCardles of the world smiled. It was the way the guys who ran the nukes smiled when they talked about atomic power facilities. The word was consideration. You want to remember it. But smart guys can learn. Yeah, Johnny? There's a dictionary back at the house. You need it, asshole?
He took a step toward Enders and had the distinct satisfaction of seeing the man fall back 2 steps, the contemptuous little smile disappearing. It was replaced with a look of nervy apprehension.
Consideration, Johnny. You remember. All of you remember. If not for me, then for Bobby.
They were standing by the equipment lean-to now, Ender's eyes small and nervous, Gardner's large and bloodshot and still angry. "And if Bobby dies, your idea of consideration may extend all the way to a quick and painless death. That's about the size of it, am I right? Would you say that just about describes the topography of this situation, you bald-headed little fuck?"
"We appreciate your plain speaking," Enders said.
His lips, with no teeth to back them up, pooched in and out nervously.
"I bet you do. Perhaps a little plain speaking of our own is in order."
He took off his glasses, began to wipe them on the sweaty front of his shirt. an action which Gardner thought would only leave them more smeared than before, and Gardner saw a dirty, furious gleam in his eyes.
"You don't want to strike out like that, Jim. I advise you, we all advise you, never to do it again. There are, changes, yes, changes going on in Haven.
No shit. And some of these changes have made people, short-tempered. So striking out like that could be, well, a bad mistake."
"Do sudden noises bother you?" Gardner inquired. Anders looked wary.
"I don't understand your because if the timer in that radio is Jake, you're about to hear one."
He stepped behind the lean-to, not quite running, but by no means lingering.
Anders threw a startled glance toward the ship, and then ran after him. He tripped over a shovel and went sprawling in the dirt, grabbing at his shin and grimacing. A moment later, a loud, crumping roar shook the earth. There was a series of those dull yet penetrating clodding sounds as chunks of rock flew against the ship's hull. Others sprayed into the air, then fell onto the edge of the cut or rattled back into it. Gardner saw one rebound from the ship's hull and bounce an amazing distance.
"You small-minded, practical, joking son of a bitch!" Anders shouted.
He was still lying on the ground, still clutching his shin.
"Small-minded? Hell!" Gardner said. "You left me down there!"
Anders glared at him. Gardner stood where he was for a moment, then walked over to him and held out his hand.
"Come on, Johnny, time to let bygones be bygones. If Stalin and Roosevelt could cooperate long enough to fight Hitler, I guess we ought to be able to cooperate long enough to unglue this sucker from the ground. What do you say?"
Anders would say nothing. But after a moment he took Gardner's hand and got up. He brushed sullenly at his clothes, occasionally favoring Gardner with an almost cat-like expression of dislike.
"Want to go see if we brought in our well yet?" Gardner asked.
He felt better than he had in days. Months, actually. Maybe even years. Blowing up at Enders had done him a world of good.
"What do you mean?"
"Never mind," Gardner said, and went over to the cut alone. He peered down, looking for water, listening for gurgles and splashes. He saw nothing, heard nothing. It seemed they had lucked out again. It suddenly occurred to him that he was standing here with his hands planted on his upper thighs, bent over a 40-foot drop with a man somewhere behind him to whom he had just administered a punch in the mouth. "If Enders wanted, he could run up behind me and tumble me into this hole with one hard push," he thought, and heard Enders saying, "Striking out like that could be a very bad mistake." But he didn't look round, and that sense of well-being, absurdly out of place or not, held. He was in a fix, and strapping a rear-view mirror onto his head so he could see who was coming up behind him wasn't going to get him out of it. When he turned around at last, Anders was still by the lean-to, looking at him with that sulky, kicked-cat expression. Gardner suspected he had been on the party line again with his fellow mutations.
"What do you say?" Gardner called over to him.
There was an edged pleasantness in his voice.
"There's a lot of broken rock down there. Do we go back to work, or do we air a few more grievances?"
Anders went into the shed, grabbed the levitation pack they used to move the bigger rocks, and started toward Gardner with it. He held it out. Gardner shouldered the pack. He started back toward the sling, then looked back at Enders.
"Don't forget to hoist me up when I yell."
"I won't." Enders' eyes, or perhaps it was only the lenses of his spectacles, were murky. Gardner discovered he didn't really care which. He put his foot into the rope sling and tightened it as Enders went back to the winch.
"Remember, Johnny, consideration. That's the word for today."
John Enders lowered him without saying anything. 4. Sunday, July 31st. Henry Buck, known to his friends as Hank, committed the last act of outright irrational craziness to take place in Haven at 11:15 on that Sunday morning. "People in Haven are short-tempered," Anders had told Gard. Ruth McCausland had seen evidences of this short temper during the search for David Brown. Hot words, scuffles, a thrown punch or two. Ironically, it had always been Ruth herself. Ruth, and the clear moral imperative she had always represented in these people's lives, who had prevented the search from turning into a free-for-all. Short-tempered? Crazy was probably a better word. In the shock of the becoming, the town had been like a gas-filled room, waiting only for someone to light a match. Or to do something even more accidental, but just as deadly, as an explosion in a gas-filled room may be set off by an innocent delivery boy pushing a doorbell and creating a spark. That spark never came. Part of it was Ruth's doing. Part of it was Bobby's doing. Then, after the visits to the shed, a group of half a dozen men and one woman began to work like the hippie LSD trip guides of the 60s, helping Haven through to the end of the first difficult stage of becoming. It was well for the people of Haven that the Big Bang never did come. Well for the people of Maine, New England, perhaps for the whole continent or the whole planet. I would not be the one to tell you there are no planets anywhere in the universe that are not large, dead cinders floating in space because a war over who was or was not hogging too many dryers in the local laundromat escalated into Doomsville. No one ever really knows where things will end, or if they will. And there had been a time in late June when the entire world might well have awakened to discover a terrible, world-dripping conflict was going on in an obscure Maine town, an exchange which had begun over something as deeply important as whose turn it had been to pick up the coffee break check at the Haven lunch. Of course, we may blow up our world some day with no outside help at all, for reasons which look every bit as trivial from a standpoint of light years, from where we rotate far out on one spoke of the Milky Way in the lesser Magellanic Cloud, whether or not the Russians invade the Iranian oil fields, or whether NATO decides to install American-made cruise missiles in West Germany, may seem every bit as important as whose turn it is to pick up the tab for five coffees and a like number of Danish. Maybe it all comes down to the same thing, when viewed from a galactic perspective. However that may be, the tense period in Haven really ended with the month of July. By this time, almost everyone in town had lost his teeth, and a number of other stranger mutations had begun. Those seven people who had visited Bobby's shed, communing with what waited in the green glow, had begun to experience these mutations some 10 days earlier, but had kept them secret. Considering the nature of the changes, that was probably wise. Because Hank Buck's revenge on Albert Pitts Barfield was really the last act of outrageous craziness in Haven. And in that light, it probably deserves a brief mention. Hank and Pitts Barfield were part of the Thursday night poker circle to which Joe Paulson had also belonged. By July 31st, the poker games had ended, and not because that bitch Becca Paulson had gone crazy and roasted her husband. They had stopped because you can't bluff at poker when all the players are telepaths. Still, Hank held a grudge against Pitts Barfield, and the more he thought about it, the more it grew in his mind. All these years, Pitts had been bottom-dealing. Several of them suspected it. Hank could remember a night in the back room of Kyle Archenborg's place 7 years ago, it must have been, playing pool with Moss Harlingen, and Moss had said, "He's bottom-dealin', just as sure as you're born, Hank. Six ball in the side." Whack! The six ball shot into the side pocket as if on a string. Thing is, bastard's good at it. If he was just a little slower, I could catch him at it. If that's what you think, you ought to get out in the game. Shit. Everyone else in that game is as honest as the day is long. And the truth is, I can outplay most of them. Nine ball, corner. Whap! Suckedly little prick is fast, and he never overuses it.
Just does a little if he really starts to go in the hole. You notice how he comes out every Thursday night? About even. Hank had. All the same, he had thought the whole thing was just a little buggy-boo in Moss's head. Moss was a good poker player, and he resented anyone whose money he couldn't take. But others had voiced a similar suspicion over the intervening years, and more than a few of them, some of them damn nice fellows, too, fellows Hank really enjoyed pulling a few beers and dealing a few hands with, had dropped out of the game. They did this quietly, with no fuss or bother, and the possibility that Pitts Barfield might be responsible was never hinted at. It was that they had finally gotten into the Monday Night Bowling League up to Bangor, and their wives didn't want them out late 2 nights a week. It was that their work schedules had changed, and they couldn't take that late night anymore. It was that winter was coming, even if it was only May, and they had to do a little work on their snowmobiles. So they dropped out, leaving the little corps of three or four that had been there all along, and somehow that made it worse, knowing that outsiders had either picked it up or smelled it as clearly as you could smell the jungle juice aroma which arose from Barfield's unwashed body most of the time. They got it. Him and Kyle and Joe had been snookered. All these years, they had been snookered. After the becoming got rolling really well, Hank discovered the truth once and for all. Not only had Pitts been doing a little basement dealing, he had also, from time to time, indulged in a little discreet card marking. He had picked these skills up in the long, monotonous hours of duty at a Berlin REPL depot in the months after the end of World War II. Some of those hot, muggy July nights, Hank would lie awake in bed, head aching, and imagine Pitts sitting in a nice, warm farmhouse, shirt and shoes off, stinking to high heaven and grinning a great, big, shittiny grin as he practiced cheating and dreamed of the suckers he would fleece when he got back home. Hank endured these dreams and headaches for 2 weeks, and then, one night, the answer came. He would just send old Pitts back to the REPL depot, that's what he would do. Some REPL depot, anyway. A REPL depot maybe 50 light-years away, or maybe 500, or 5 million. A REPL depot in the Phantom Zone. And Hank knew just how to do it. He sat bolt upright in bed, grinning a huge grin. His headache was gone at last. "Just what the hell is a REPL depot, anyway?" he muttered, and then decided that it was the least of his problems. He got out of bed and set to work right then at 3 in the morning. He caught up to Pitts a week after the idea had struck him. Pitts was sitting in front of Cooter's Market, tipped back in a chair and looking at the pictures in a gallery magazine. Looking at pictures of naked women, bottom dealing, and stinking up REPL depots, these were the specialities of Pitts Barfield, Hank decided. It was Sunday, overcast and hot. People saw Hank walking toward where Albert Pitts Barfield sat tipped back in his chair, work boots curled around the front rungs, checking out all those girls next door. They felt, heard, the one thought beating steadily. REPL depot, REPL depot, REPL depot, REPL depot. In Hank's mind, they saw the great big ghetto blaster radio he was carrying by the handle, saw the pistol jammed into the front of his pants, and they stepped away quickly. Pitts was deeply absorbed in the gallery gatefold. It showed a great deal of a girl named Candy, whose hobbies, the magazine said, included sailing and men with hands, both strong and gentle. And he looked up far too late to do anything constructive on his own behalf. Considering the size of the pistol Hank was carrying, people opined, usually without even opening their mouths except to shovel in more food, over supper that night, it had probably been too late for poor old Pitts when he got up that Sunday morning. Pitts' chair came down with a bang. "Hey, Hank, what—" Hank pulled the gun. It was a souvenir of his own army service. He had done his time in Korea, and not in any REPL depot either. "You just want to sit right there," Hank said, "or they're going to be washing your guts off that store window, you cheating son of a bitch."
Hank! Hank! What?
Hank reached inside his shirt and brought out a small pair of Borg earphones. He jacked them into the big radio, turned it on, and tossed the phones toward Pitts.
Put them on, Pitts. Let's see you deal your way out of this one. Hank, please.
I ain't going to treat with you on this, Pitts, Hank said with great sincerity. I'll give you a 5 count to put on those earphones, and then I'm going to give you a sinus operation.
Christ, Hank! It was a fucking quarter-limit poker game!
Pitts screamed. Sweat poured down his face, stained his khaki shirt. The smell of him was large, vinegary, and amazingly repugnant.
One? Two?
Pitts looked around wildly. There was no one there. The street had cleared magically. There wasn't so much as a car to be seen moving on Main Street, although there were plenty slant parked in front of the market. Complete silence had fallen. In it, both he and Hank could hear the music coming from the earphones. Los Lobos, wondering if the wolf would survive.
It was a lousy, three-race, quarter-limit poker game, and I hardly ever did it anyway.
Pitts shrieked.
Somebody, for Christ's sake, put a halter over this guy!
Three. And with a final ludicrous defiance, Pitts screamed,
And he's a sore fucking loser!
Four, Hank said, and raised his service pistol. Pitts, his entire shirt now stained nearly black with sweat, his eyes rolling, smelling like a manure pile which had just been napalmed, gave in.
Okay, 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 he screamed,
and picked up the earphones.
I'm doing it, see? I'm doing it!
He put the phones on. Still holding the pistol on him, Hank bent over the ghetto blaster, which could play cassette tapes as well as receive AM and FM stations. The play button below the cassette holder had been taped over. Written on the tape was this one rather ominous word. Send. Hank pushed it. Pitts started to scream. Then the screams began to fade, as if someone inside were turning down his volume. At the same time, someone seemed to be turning down his vividness, his physical coherence, his there-ness. Pitts Barfield faded like a photograph. Now his mouth was moving soundlessly, his skin was milk. A little piece of reality, a piece of reality roughly the size of a Dutch door's lower half, seemed to open behind him. There was a feeling that reality, haven reality, had rotated on some unknowable axis, like a trick bookcase in a haunted house spoof. Behind Pitts now was an eerie purple-black landscape. Hank's hair began to flutter about his ears. His collar stuttered with a sound like a silenced automatic weapon. The litter on the asphalt. Candy wrappers, flattened cigarette packages, a couple of Humpty Dumpty potato chip bags, zoomed across the pavement and into that hole. They were drawn on the river of air which flowed into that nearly airless other place. Some of that litter went between Pitt's legs, and some, Hank thought, seemed to pass right through him. Then, suddenly, as if he himself had become as light as the litter which had been on the market's paved apron, Pitts was vacuumed into that hole. His gallery magazine went after him, pages flapping like bat wings.
Good for you, you fuckface, Hank thought. Now you got something to read in the Repple-Depple.
Pitts' chair toppled over, scraped across the asphalt, and lodged half in, half out of that opening. A wind tunnel of air was now rushing around Hank. He bent over his radio, finger coming to rest on the stop button. Just before he pushed it, he heard a high, thin cry coming from that other place. He looked up, thinking,
That ain't Pitts.
It came again.
Hilly?
Hank frowned. It was a kid's voice. A kid's voice. And there was something familiar about it, something...
Over yet? I want to come home.
It was a bright, toneless jingle as the window in Cooter's Market, which had blown inward in the town hall explosion the previous Sunday, was now sucked outward. A glass storm flew all around Hank, leaving him miraculously untouched.
Please,
It's hard to breathe.
Now the B&M beans on special, which had been pyramided in the market's front window, began to fly around Hank as they were sucked through the doorway in reality he had somehow opened. 5-pound bags of lawn food and 10-pound bags of charcoal slithered across the pavement with dry, papery sounds. "Gotta shut the sucker up," Hank thought. And as if to confirm this judgment, a can of beans slammed into the back of his head, bounced high in the air, then zoomed into that purple-black bruise.
"Hilly!"
Hank hit the stop button. The doorway disappeared at once. There was a woody crunch as the chair lodged in the opening was cut in two, on an almost perfect diagonal. Half of the chair lay on the asphalt. The other half was nowhere to be seen. Randy Kroger, the German who had owned Cooter's since the late 50s, grabbed Hank and turned him around.
"You're paying for that display window, Buck," he said.
"Sure, Randy, whatever you say," Hank agreed, dazedly rubbing the lump that was rising on the back of his head. Kroger pointed at the strange slanting half-chair lying on the asphalt.
"You're paying for the chair, too," he announced,
and strode back inside.
That was how July ended. 5. Monday, August 1st. John Leandro finished talking, knocked back the rest of his beer, and asked David Bright,
"So? What do you think he'll say?"
Bright thought for a moment. He and Leandro were in the Bounty Tavern, a wildly overdecorated Bangor pub with only two real marks in its favor. It was almost directly across the street from the editorial offices of the Bangor Daily News, and on Mondays you could get Heineken for $1 a bottle.
"I think he'll start by telling you to hurry over to Derry and finish getting the rest of the community calendar," Bright said. "Then I think he might ask you if you've thought about psychiatric help."
Leandro looked absurdly crushed. He was only 24, and the last two stories he had covered, the disappearance, read presumed murder, of the two state troopers, and the suicide of a third, had whetted his appetite for the high-voltage stuff. When stacked up against being on a grim midnight hunt for the bodies of two state troopers, reporting on the Derry Amvet's covered dish supper wasn't much. He didn't want the heavy stuff to end. Bright felt almost sorry for the little twerp. Trouble was, that was what Leandro was. Being a twerp at 24 was acceptable. He was pretty sure, however, that Johnny Leandro was still going to be a twerp at 44, 64, at 84, if he lived that long. A twerp of 84 was a slightly awesome and wholly frightening idea. Bright decided to order another beer after all.
"I was just joking," Bright said.
"Then you think he will let me follow it up?"
"No.
But you just said..."
"I was joking about the psychiatric help part," Bright said patiently. "That's what I was joking about." He was Peter Renault, the city editor. Bright had learned a good many years ago that city editors had one thing in common with God himself, and he suspected that Johnny Leandro was about to learn it himself very soon now. Reporters might propose, but it was city editors like Peter Renault who eventually disposed.
"But you have nothing to follow up," Bright said.
If Haven's inner circle, those who had made the trip into Bobby Anderson's shed, could have heard what Leandro said next, his life expectancy might well have sunk to days, maybe mere hours.
"I've got Haven to follow up," was what he said,
and quaffed the rest of his Heineken dark in three long swallows.
"Everything starts there. The kid disappears in Haven, the woman dies in Haven, Rhodes and Gabbins are coming back from Haven, Dugan commits suicide. Why? Because he loved the McCausland woman, he says. The McCausland woman... from Haven."
"Don't forget lovable old Gramps," Bright said. "He's running around saying his grandson's disappearance was a conspiracy. I kept expecting him to start whispering about Fu Manchu and white slavery."
So what is it?
Leandro asked dramatically.
What's going on in Haven?
It is the insidious doctor, Bright said. His beer arrived. He no longer wanted it. He only wanted to get out of here. Bringing up lovable old Gramps had been a mistake. Thinking about lovable old Gramps made him feel a trifle uneasy. Gramps was obviously off his rocker, but there had been something about his eyes.
What?
Dr. Fu Manchu, if you see Nayland Smith hanging around, I think you've got the story of the century. Bright leaned forward and whispered hoarsely, White slavery. Remember who you heard it from when you get the call from the New York Times.
I don't think that's very funny, David.
An 84-year-old twerp, Bright thought again.
Imagine it.
Or here's one, Bright said. Little green men. The invasion of Earth is already underway, see? Only no one knows it. And ta-da! No one will believe this heroic young news hawk. Robert Redford stars as John Leandro in this nail-biting saga of... The bartender wandered down and said, You want to turn it down? Leandro got up, his face stiff. He dropped $3 bills on the bar.
Your sense of humor is adolescent, David.
Or try this, Bright said dreamily. It's both Fu Manchu and Green Men from Space, an alliance formed in hell, and no one knows but you, Johnny. Klaatu Barada Niktu.
Well, I don't care if Renault lets me follow it up or not, Leandro said,
and Bright saw that he might have twanged Johnny's strings just a little too hard. The twerp was furious.
My vacation starts next Friday. I may just go down to Haven, follow it up on my own time.
Sure, Bright said, excited. He knew he should let up. Pretty soon Leandro was probably going to try to punch him in the mouth, but the guy just kept giving him openings.
Sure, that's got to be part of it.
Redford wouldn't take the part unless he could go it alone. The lone wolf, Klaatu Barada Niktu.
Wow!
Just remember to wear your special watch when you go down there. What watch? Leandro asked, his face still angry. Oh, he was pissed, all right, but he kept leading with his chin just the same.
You know, the one that sends out an ultrasonic signal that only Superman can hear when you pull out the stem, Bright said,
demonstrating with his own watch and spilling a fair amount of beer into his crotch. It goes, zee.
I don't care what Peter Renault thinks, and I don't care how many stupid jokes you make, Leandro said. You both just might get a big surprise.
He started out, then turned back.
And for the record, I think you're a cynical shithead with no imagination.
Having delivered this valedictory, Johnny Leandro turned on his heel and stalked grandly out. Bright lifted his glass and tipped it toward the bartender. Let's drink to the cynical shitheads of the world, he said. We have no imagination, but we're remarkably resistant to twerpism.
Whatever you say, the bartender said.
He believed he had seen it all before, but then he had never tended bar in Haven. 6. Tuesday, August 2nd. There were six of them who met late that afternoon in Newt Barringer's office. It was going on 5 p.m., but the clock in the tower, a tower that looked real but which a bird could easily have flown through, if there had been any birds left in Haven Village, still read 3:05. All six had spent some time in Bobby's shed. Adley McKean was the most recent addition to their number. The others included Newt, Dick Allison, Kyle, Hazel, and Frank Spruce. They discussed the few things they had to discuss without talking aloud. Frank Spruce asked how Bobby was.
Still alive, Newt responded. No one knew anymore. She might come out of the shed again. More likely she would not. Either way, they would know when it happened.
Discussion turned briefly to what Hank Buck had done the day before, and what Hank said he'd heard coming from that other world. None of them were much concerned with the late and not-so-great Pitts Barfield. Perhaps the punishment had suited the crime. Perhaps it had been a little too extreme,
It didn't matter. It was over. Nothing had happened to Hank as a result of what he had done. He had given Randy Kroger a personal check for the broken display window and the goods that had been sucked through the hole Hank had spiked into reality. Kroger called Northern National and Bangor to verify the check. He found it was good, and that was all he cared about. There was little they could have done about Hank, even if they'd had a mind to. The town's one jail cell was in the town hall's basement, a converted storeroom where Ruth had jugged a few weekend drunks, and it might hold Hank Buck for all of 10 minutes. A strong 14-year-old could have broken out of it. And they couldn't very well send Hank up to county jail. The charge would have looked pretty odd. The alternatives available to them were simple. Let him alone, or pack him off to Altair 4. Luckily, they were able to look closely into Hank's mind and motivations. They saw that his anger and confusion were subsiding, as they were all over town. He was not apt to do anything radical again, so they took away his converted radio, asked him not to make another, and moved on to what concerned them a bit more, the voice he claimed to have heard. It was David Brown, all right, Frank Spruce said now. Anybody doubt it? No one did. David Brown was on Altair 4. No one knew exactly where Altair 4 was, or what it was, and they didn't much care. The words themselves came from some old movie and meant no more than the name Tommyknockers, which came from some old rhyme. What mattered, and even this didn't much, was that Altair 4 was a kind of cosmic warehouse, a place where all sorts of things were stored. Hank had sent Pitts there. But first he had put the smelly old son of a bitch through some half-assed sort of disintegration process. This had apparently not been the case with David Brown. Long, thoughtful silence.
Yes, probably, yes.
This last was not ascribable to any one person. It was groupthink, hive-like, and complete in itself.
But why? Why bother?
They looked at each other with no emotion. They could feel emotion, but not over such a minor matter as this.
Bring him back, Hazel said indifferently. It'll please Bryant and Marie.
And Ruth. She would have wanted it. And we all did love her, you know. Her thought had the tone of a woman suggesting that a friend buy her son a soft drink as a treat for being good.
No, Adley said, and they all looked toward him. It was the first time he had entered their conversation.
He looked embarrassed, but pushed on anyway. Every paper and TV station in the state would be down here to get a story on the miracle return. They think he must be dead. Only 4, and gone over 2 weeks now. If he shows up, it'll make too much whoop-de-doo.
They were nodding now.
And what would he say? Newt put in. When they asked him where he'd been, what would he say?
We could blank his memories, Hazel said. That would be no problem at all, and the press people would accept amnesia as perfectly natural, under the circumstances.
Yes, but that's not the problem. It was the many voices again, as one voice. They came together in a strange combination of words and images. The problem was that things had now gone too far to allow anyone in town except for the most transient through travelers. And even most of them could be discouraged with fake road construction and detour signs. The last people they wanted in Haven were a bunch of reporters and TV camera crews. And the clock tower wouldn't show up on film. It was a mind slide, really no more than a hallucination.
No, David Brown was best left alone, all things considered. He would be all right for yet a while.
They knew little about Altair 4, but they did know that time ran at a different speed there. On Altair 4, less than a year had passed since Earth had been flung out of the sun. So David Brown had, in fact, just gotten there. Of course, he still might die. Strange microbes might invade his system. Some strange Altair 4 warehouse rat might gobble him up. Or he might die of simple shock. But he probably wouldn't. And if he did, it really wasn't very important. I've a feeling the boy might come in handy, Kyle said.
How?
As a diversion. What do you mean?
Kyle didn't know exactly what he meant.
It was only a feeling that if a spotlight were to be trained on Haven again, the way Ruth had tried to train one on the town with her damned exploding dolls, which had worked ever so much better than they were supposed to work, perhaps they could bring David Brown back and set him down somewhere else. If that was done in the right way, they might gain a little more time here. Time was always a problem. Time to become. Kyle expressed these ideas in no coherent way, but the others nodded at the drift of his thoughts. It would be well to keep David Brown waiting in the wings, so to speak, a while longer.
Don't let Marie know. She hasn't gone far enough in the becoming. You must hide this from Marie yet a while.
All six looked around, eyes widening. That voice, weak but clear, belonged to none of them. It had come from Bobby Anderson.
Bobby! Hazel cried, half rising from her seat. Bobby, are you all right? How are you doing?
No answer. Bobby was gone. There was not even a feel of her left in the air. They looked at each other cautiously, testing each other's impressions of that thought, confirming that it had been Bobby. Each knew that if he or she had been alone, with no confirmation available, he or she would have dismissed it as an incredibly powerful hallucination.
"How are we going to keep it from Marie?" Dick Allison asked, almost angrily. "We can't hide nothing from anybody else."
"Yes," Newt returned. "We can. Not good enough yet, maybe, but we can dim out our thoughts a little. Make them hard to see, because we've been out there, been in the shed, Bobby's shed. We wore the headphones in Bobby's shed, and ate to become. Take ye, eat, do this in remembrance of me."
A sigh ran gently through them.
"We'll have to go back," Adley McKean said.
"Won't we?"
"Yes," Kyle said, "we will." It was the only time anyone spoke aloud during the entire meeting, and it marked its end.
7. Wednesday, August 3rd. Andy Bozeman, who had been Haven's only realtor up until 3 weeks ago, when he simply closed his office, had discovered that mind-reading was something a fellow got used to very quickly. He didn't realize how quickly, or how much he had come to depend on it, until it was his turn to go on out to Bobby's place to help, and to keep an eye on the drunk. Part of his problem, he knew it was going to be a problem after talking to Enders and the Tremaine lad, was being this close to the ship. It was like standing next to the biggest power generator in the world. Constant eddies and flows of its weird force ran over his skin like skirling sand devils in the desert. Sometimes large ideas would float dreamily into his mind, making it impossible to concentrate on what he was doing. Sometimes the exact opposite would occur. Thought would break up completely, like a microwave transmission interrupted by a burst of ultraviolet rays. But most of it was just the physical fact of the ship, looming there like something out of a dream. It was exhilarating, awe-inspiring, frightening, wonderful. Bozeman thought he now understood how the Israelites must have felt carrying the Ark of the Covenant through the desert. In one of his sermons, the Reverend Gooringer said that some fellow had ventured to stick his head in there just to see what all the shouting was about, and he had dropped dead on the spot. Because it had been God in there. There might be a kind of God in that ship, too, Andy thought. And even if that God had fled, it had left some residue, some of itself. And thinking about it made it hard to keep your mind on the business at hand. Then there was Gardner's unsettling blankness. You kept running into it like a closed door that should have been open. You'd yell at him to hand you something, and he would go right on with what he was doing. Just no response. Or you'd go to tune in on him,
just sort of fall into the run of his thoughts, like picking up a telephone on a party line to see who was talking. And there would be no one there. No one at all. Nothing but a dead line. There was a buzz from the intercom nailed to the inside wall of the lean-to. Its wire ran across the muddy, churned ground and into the trench from which the ship jutted. Bozeman flipped the toggle over to talk.
"I'm here."
"The charge is set," Gardner said. "Haul me up." He sounded very, very tired. He had thrown himself a pretty fair country drunk last night, Bozeman thought, judging by the sound of the puking he had heard from the back porch around midnight. And when he glanced into Gardner's room this morning, he had seen blood on his pillow.
"Right away."
The episode with Enders had taught them all that when Gardner asked to be brought up, you didn't waste time. He went to the windlass and began to crank. It was a pain in the ass having to do this by hand, but there was a temporary shortage of batteries again. Give them another week, and everything out here would be running like clockwork. Except Bozeman doubted if he would be here to see it. Being near the ship was exhausting. Being near Gardner was exhausting in a different way. It was like being near a loaded gun that had a hair trigger. The way he had sucker-punched poor John Enders now. The only reason John hadn't known it was coming was because Gardner was such an infuriating blank. Every now and then a bubble of thought, partial or complete, would rise to the surface of his mind, as readable as a newspaper headline. But that was all. Maybe Enders had it coming. Bozeman knew that he wouldn't be too nuts about being stuck at the bottom of a trench with one of those explosive radios, but that wasn't the point. The point was that Johnny hadn't been able to see it coming. Gardner could do anything at any time, and no one could stop him, because no one could see it coming. Andy Bozeman almost wished Bobby would die so that they could get rid of him. It would be tougher with just Havenites working on the project, true, it would slow them down, but it would almost be worth it. The way he could come out of left field at you was so fucking unsettling. This morning, for instance. Coffee break. Bozeman, sitting on a stump, eating some of those little peanut butter and cracker sandwiches and drinking iced coffee from his thermos. He had always preferred hot coffee to cold, even in warm weather, but since he'd lost his teeth, really hot drinks seemed to bother him. Gardner had been sitting cross-legged, like one of those yoga masters on a dirty swatch of tarpaulin, eating an apple and drinking a beer. Bozeman didn't see how anyone could eat an apple and drink a beer at the same time, especially in the morning. But Gardner was doing it. From here, Bozeman could see the scar an inch or so above Gardner's left eyebrow. The steel plate would be under that scar. Gardner had turned his head and caught Bozeman looking at him. Bozeman flushed, wondering if Gardner was going to start to yell and rant, if maybe he was going to come over here and try to sucker-punch him the way he had Johnny Enders. If he tries that, Bozeman thought, curling his hands into fists, he's going to find that I'm no sucker. Instead, Gard had begun to speak in a clear, carrying voice. There was a small, cynical smile on his mouth as he did it. After a moment, Bozeman realized he wasn't just speaking, he was reciting. The man was sitting out here in the woods, cross-legged, on a dirty tarp, hung over out of his mind, the glittering body of the ship in the earth casting moving ripples of reflection on his cheek, and reciting like a schoolboy. The man was unfucking stable, Bozeman would tell the world. He sincerely wanted Gardner dead. Tom gave up the brush with reluctance in his face, but alacrity at his heart. Gardner said, his eyes half closed, face turned up toward the warm morning sun. That little smile never left his lips. And while the late steamer Big Missouri worked and sweated in the sun, the retired artist sat on a barrel in the shade close by, dangled his legs, munched his apple, and planned the slaughter of more innocents. "What?" Andy began, but Gardner, his smile now spreading into a genuine, if nonetheless cynical, grin, overrode him. There was no lack of material. Boys happened along every little while. They came to jeer, but they remained to whitewash. By the time Ben was fagged out, Tom had traded the next chance to Billy Fisher for a kite in good repair, and when he played out, Johnny Miller bought in for a dead rat and a string to swing it with. Gardner drank the rest of his beer, belched, and stretched.
"You never brought me a dead rat and a string to swing it with, but I got an intercom, Bosey, and I guess that's a start, huh?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," Bozeman said slowly. He had only gotten 2 years of college, business admin, before having to drop out and go to work. His father had a heart condition and chronic high blood pressure. High-flown fellows like this made him nervous and angry, lording it over ordinary folks, as if being able to quote from something written by someone